Jessica Ramos from Trade Unionist in Solidarity with Colombia summarized the struggle at the Coca-Cola bottling plants in Colombia.
We can no longer sit still. We can no longer keep quiet as we learn of the atrocities these men and women in Colombia are experiencing. Threats, kidnappings, tortures, and murders have taken place in response to unionization. We believe earning a living wage in order to provide ourselves and our families with food, shelter, and clothing is a human right, and we will stop at nothing to defend it.
Luis Adolfo Cardona witnessed the assassination of union contract negotiator Isidro Segundo Gil at the Carepa bottling plant in 1996, and he had to flee the country after paramilitaries attempted to kidnap him.
This week in Radical History for the week starting February 9th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. Here's a tiny bit more about one radical struggle in Colombia. Thanks for listening.
I noticed the paramilitaries had jumped back onto the motorcycle and were fleeing the scene. When I reached his body, I put my hands under his head. At that point, I realized that his head had come apart in my hands. My hands were covered in his blood. I noticed that his two young daughters rushed towards him and now in his pool of blood were telling him, "Daddy, Daddy, wake up, don't leave us."
This week in Radical History for February 9th, 1886, President Cleveland declares a state of emergency in Seattle because of anti-Chinese violence. Since the disgraceful butchery of the Chinese in Wyoming several months ago, the anti-Chinese feeling in the extreme Northwest has become more violent and nearly universal. Following a declaration that Chinese are, quote, immoral and degraded and a constant menace to free institutions, to the home, and to the family. The Chinese were the Mexicans of their day. Now neo-Nazi skinheads are on the rise in this country and all over the world.
Hate crimes against Latinos have risen nearly 40% since 2003. The National Hispanic Media Coalition wants to know whether a spike in anti-Latino hate speech on TV and radio, coming not just from the fringes but well-known talkers like Michael Savage and Rush Limbaugh, is contributing to the violence. Last week, the group called upon the Federal Communications Commission to investigate the relationship between hate speech and hate crimes.
This is a national epidemic. The growth is spurred each day by hate speech, distortion of facts, and anti-immigrant sentiment expressed on cable shows, local radio shows, and across the airwaves. The serious topic of immigration has been contaminated by hatred and racism, and it's created a toxic climate which fosters and condones violence, all motivated by bigotry.
The more we forget our own history, the more horrors will be revisited. Also on February 9, 1917, San Francisco labor agitator Tom Mooney is falsely convicted of a fatal bombing. He is pardoned and released 22 and a half years later. Thomas Mooney's show trial was conducted in a lynch mob atmosphere and featured several witnesses whose testimony was coached by the prosecutor. It included one witness who claimed her astral body was at the scene. Also on February 9, 1982, President George Bush Sr. denies he ever used the phrase voodoo economics and challenges anybody to find it. NBC's Ken Doty promptly broadcast the 1980 tape in which he has said the phrase.
Does anyone know what Vice President Bush called this in 1980? Anyone? Something D-O-O economics. Voodoo economics. Voodoo economics. Voodoo economics. Voodoo economics. Anyone? Anyone?
Lastly, for February 9, 1994, a Senate report reveals the U.S. did ship biological agents, WMD, to Iraq with Reagan's approval. Just in case there's any debate about that.
Anyone? Anyone?
This week in Radical History for February 10, 1855. The Women's Hospital in New York City is founded. Although it did provide much-needed care for poor women, the hospital is also an arena for J. Marion Sims, known for his hatred of women and ruthlessly cutting up their bodies. Here he will perform brutal operations using indigent women as guinea pigs before audience of men. Sims began his career performing dangerous sexual surgeries on black slave women who were housed in a stable in his yard. On one particular slave, he performed 30 operations. After the affiliation with New York Women's Hospital, Sims performed the same number of operations on an Irish indigent Mary Smith. Internationally famous and honored by his peers, Sims was the object of adulation from the Harvard Medical School, counted as one of the immortals. I guess you can be immortal if you sold your soul to the devil.
Anyone? Anyone?
Also on February 10, 1892 in Spain, four farm workers are executed during a repression following an uprising in January of Jerez, setting off a new wave of violence in Spain. Last month, hundreds of farm workers calling them a social revolution took over the town of Jerez The insurrection was quickly subdued and leaders captured and tortured. Anarchists would fight a good fight for years in Spain, including in 1932, the anarcho-syndicalist NCT proclaimed general strike and more insurrections followed. Within the week, the Catalonia city of Teresa is taken over and anarchist commune is declared. Two more items for February 10, 1961. The Voice of Nuclear Disarmament pirate radio station begins operating off the shores of England. Last Santa State in 1962. Francis Gary Powers, a CIA pilot in a super-secret U-2 airplane, is captured by the Russians. When the United States government learned that Powers disappeared over the Soviet Union, it issued a cover statement claiming that a weather plane had crashed down after a pilot had difficulties with his oxygen tank. What U.S. officials did not realize was the plane crashed almost fully intact and the equipment was obviously not used for weather forecasting since it was long-range telescoping lens that aimed down. After Powers had finally returned to the United States, he is criticized by his handlers for not using the CIA-issued suicide pin. I wonder if that suicide pin was the flag lapel pin on his jacket.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, February 11th in 1916, black feminist and American civil rights activist Florence Kennedy was born in Kansas City, Missouri. Flo Kennedy began her career as a lawyer, but quickly lost faith in the American judicial system and decided that practicing law might never be an effective means of changing society or resisting oppression. Flo turned to political activism and in 1966 set up an organization called the Media Workshop to fight racism in journalism and advertising. She continued her struggle for justice both in the courts and on the streets, aligning herself with movements from the Black Panther Party to abortion rights, and even publicly rallied against the Vietnam War. Flo's political activism extended in all directions, and one of her favorite mottos was that you have to fight on all the fronts, all the time. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also this week in Radical History, on February 11th, 1978, Longest Walk begins. 300 Native Americans start march from Alcatraz in San Francisco, California to Washington, D.C., organized by the American Indian Movement, AIM, to shine a light on the plight of indigenous peoples in America. Also on February 11, 1987, President Reagan tells the Tower Commission he did not approve arms sales to Iran, which was a lie. After the weapons sales were revealed in November of 1986, Ronald Reagan appeared on national television and stated that the weapons transfer he intended to occur, but the United States did not trade arms for hostages. The investigation was compromised when large volumes of documents relating to the scandal were destroyed or withheld from investigators by the Reagan administration officials. Same old, same old. Only two more items for February 11, 1990. South Africa political prisoner Nelson Mandela is released after 27 years in prison by the U.S.-supported apartheid government of South Africa. Also on the state in 2006, duck everybody duck. After a couple of noon toddies, Vice President Dick Cheney, armed and dangerous with a shotgun, peppers a millionaire contributor, shooting him in the face while bird hunting.
This is your Radio Works reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 12th, in 1853, Illinois passed a law stating that no black person from another state was allowed to stay in their state for more than 10 days. If they were caught, they were to be arrested and either subject to a $50 fine or temporarily auctioned into forced labor. These laws, known as black laws, were extremely common in the southern states, and the state of Illinois had particularly harsh tactics. Although Illinois entered the Union as a free state in 1818, slavery had existed there for almost 100 years and continued to exist for a long time. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on February 12, 1913, Mary Harris Mother Jones leads a protest of conditions in the West Virginia mines and is arrested. A government official once called Mary Jones the most dangerous woman in America. She was very dangerous to the establishment order because she was fearless in her defense of the oppressed working class. For 60 years, she went into mining towns where men often feared to go, organizing unions. The miners called her Mother Jones, and she is still out organizing up to the age of 83. This week in radical history for February 13, 1633, Italian astronomer Galileo arrives in Rome before his trial of the Inquisition for professing beliefs that the Earth revolves around the Sun. Now, how silly can that be? Remember, the Pope is infallible. Also on February 13, 1921, Peter Potemkin's funeral is held in Moscow. It would be the last public anarchist gathering and last non-state-sponsored mass assembly in Russia for 70 years. As Lenin, Trotsky, and the Bolsheviks begin a crackdown to secure their power over the working class. Under the pressure of libertarians and anarchists, prisoners were allowed to attend Potemkin's funeral. The crowd was estimated over 100,000 following the coffin to the cemetery. Black flags are deployed and banners proclaiming, "Where there is authority, there is no freedom." Also on February 13, 1945 in Germany, over 130,000 killed as the Allied firebombing of Dresden occurs. Remains little known event in today's history, as the Allies downplay the slaughter of innocents. In a three-day period, 3,400 tons of explosives and incinerators were dropped, reducing 6 square miles of the city to rubble. Many Allied officials were outraged. Germany was clearly on the verge of collapse, and Dresden was not a German war production city. Dresden had been famous for its artworks and historical buildings until it became victim of the single most devastating air raid of World War II. Also on this date in 1967 in the United States, National Student Association reveals that it was secretly and indirectly receiving more than $3 million from the CIA over a 15-year period. NSA President Eugene Grove denies any money was used for intelligence work. Yeah, right. The funds given by the NSA were used in a variety of projects, all approved beforehand by CIA officials. As he told the New York Times, some of the information apparently was passed directly to the CIA employees, and some of it, in the course of normal business, went to the files of the NSA, to be later accessed by clandestine operations within the association. Those students have signed secrecy oaths with the CIA would then be bound by penalty of law to keep their knowledge of the ultimate benefactor from the public and the rest of their organization. CIA money, domestic spying. Think I've heard this before. People, the
time has come. This is your Radio Works reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 13th, 1971, the Southeast Asian country of Laos was under severe attack by South Vietnam and the U.S., who encouraged and supported the invasion. Presenting a huge threat to American war interests, Laos played a key role in the Vietnam War. This war, commonly known as the Secret War, turned Laos into one of the most manipulated and exploited battlegrounds used between America and North Vietnam. The war left Laos in political disaster. Also, the Laotians who were recruited to help the U.S. became despised in Laos, and the U.S. left them at the end of the war in a very bad situation. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Lastly, for February 13, 1995, Chase Manhattan Bank distanced itself from a newsletter calling for Mexico to eliminate the Zapatista rebels in Mexico, according to the New York Times. The Chase Bank pointed to the uprising in Chiapas as a major element in the fight for foreign investors. Mexican security forces began a large-scale takeover of the former rebel areas on February 9th, less than a month after the memo was published. Mexican security forces engaged in widespread violation of human rights that continue to this day. The memo also suggested that the Mexican government might not find it convenient to honor the results of the upcoming elections. This uprising has boosted the price of the Mexican Indian blood, said by a man known as Subcomandante Marcos, who led the Zapatista National Liberation Army in Chiapas. Not long ago, it was valued less than 2 chickens. Now it is a condition of the largest loan in history, Subcomandante Marcos said, referring to the $40 billion loan proposed by the Clinton and his neoliberal friends. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 14th in 1804, New Jersey became the last northern state to abolish slavery. Actually, the legislation called for the gradual abolition of slavery, and it aimed to phase slavery out over a 25-year period. Ironically, the act granted financial benefits to slave owners. In the years since, New Jersey has built itself a rather bad reputation as far as racial discrimination and police brutality goes. The New Jersey state troopers are often accused of targeted racial profiling and violent tactics. the names Asada Shakur, Zaid Malik Shakur, and Sundiata Akola come to mind. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Okay, coming close to the end of the show, this week in Radical History, also for February 14th, 1895, Oscar Wilde's comedy, The Importance of Being Earnest, opens in London. A free thinker, Oscar once said, "Disobedience in the eyes of anyone who has read history is man's original virtue. It is through disobedience that progress has been made, through disobedience and through rebellion." Hear, hear, my man. Lastly, for February 14th, 1991 in Iraq, while the military and American press are gaga with their proclamations of precision bombing, U.S. warplanes bomb civilian shelter, killing at least 500 in Baghdad. Happy Valentine's Day from good old Uncle Sam. This week in Radical History for February 15th, I only have one item. 2003. Over 15 million people around the world in over 300 cities demonstrate in opposition to the American government's agenda to overthrow the government of Iraq through military invasion. Up to 2 million demonstrate in London, up to 3 million demonstrate in Rome, 1.3 million in Barcelona, 600,000 in Madrid, up to 500,000 in Berlin, 200,000 in Damascus, 200,000 plus protests in New York City, ringed by police snipers, 30,000 protests in Los Angeles, and about 25,000 hit the streets in Seattle, and over 1,000 in my small little hometown. All that effort, all that organizing did nothing. The voice of the people stopped nothing. And after the war started, most anti-war protesters stayed at home. Yeah, that showed the Bush administration what's what. To quote MASH, "War never ends, they just take it on the road."
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. We begin this week with the campaign by various vestiges of the Israeli lobby to silence pro-Palestinian voices on the U.S. campus. Recently, the Electronic Intifada made available on their website links to the long-suppressed Al Jazeera video that exposes the magnitude of the organized, well-financed pushback against the Palestinian narrative by a variety of Zionist organizations, some underground, on our college campuses. I want to focus this story by reading a Mondawais article written by Nada Elia, a Palestinian scholar, activist, writer, grassroots organizer, currently completing a book on the Palestinian diaspora. Nada reports on the current campus controversy. She writes, "Last week I was asked to speak in a classroom alongside someone from the Jewish group Stand With Us. Apparently the professor was going by a recommendation to have me as a discussant to possibly provide the, quote, other side. Without getting into a discussion of what those two sides are, pro-apartheid and pro-justice, of course, or why I will not be party to normalizing, setting up the illusion that both sides are equal, rather than oppressor and oppressed, occupier and occupied, I sent this response, which I tried to keep short and to the point. Thank you for the request, which I must decline. I must also say that I find it quite worrisome that you would have representatives of this group talk to our students. Stand With Us is a right-wing propaganda organization which actively stifles free speech and critical thinking by equating any and all criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism. This is extremely intimidating for students attempting to formulate their own thoughts about the topic and distracts from the real anti-Semitism that targets all Jews, regardless of their political ideology. Jewish Voice for Peace mentions Stand With Us among the more aggressive organizations stifling dissent on campuses and in various political circles in their extremely valuable report. I trust you agree with me that we are living in troubling times. The current national climate, indeed the global climate in which the Trump and Netanyahu administrations are working hard and hand in hand, should impress us with a need to critically disentangle anti-Semitism from anti-Zionism, the latter being criticism of and oppositions to a political worldview, albeit one held by many Jews. Of course, you must also be aware of the fact that, numerically speaking, there are millions more Christian Zionists than Jewish Zionists. The distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism is one that activists for Palestinian rights have long been arguing, yet one that keeps getting blurred by organizations such as Stand With Us, which persists in their claim that criticism of Israel's policies is a thinly disguised form of Jew hatred. I hope you can present the students with the appropriate context for having representatives of this group talk to them in your class. Best, Nada. Nada continues her article. As I consider this request, which coincided with the National Students for Justice in Palestine, NSJP, annual conference, which both the City of Los Angeles and the host school, the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA, tried to ban, and in light of the numerous violations of the academic freedom of anti-Zionist faculty and students across the country, I couldn't help but marvel at how some administrators bend over backwards to accommodate any representatives and requests from Zionist organizations, while also bending over backwards to censor and criminalize any representative and requests from the pro-Palestinian rights organizations. UCLA even sought a cease and desist against NSJP for using a bear in their poster for fear the image would be viewed as the school's mascot and thus interpreted as official endorsement of the conference. In their cease and desist letter, NSJP, UCLA administrators also demanded that the poster advertising the conference not show the bear flying kites, as this would be viewed as an incitement to violence. As NSJP wrote in their statement, UCLA's action demonstrates how out of touch they are with the facts and how quickly they are willing to associate the Palestinian rights movement with harmful, broad-sweeping stereotypes and caricatures. That knee-jerk response from such university administrators is similar to that of law enforcement officers who can somehow take mass killers alive if they are white. Think Dylann Roof, who was offered a burger and fries when he complained he was hungry, and more recently, Tree of Life Synagogue mass killer Robert Bowers, even though he had actually shot at three cops, but kill African-American children in their sleep, on the playground, and outside their homes, or shoot adult African-Americans for, let's see, driving, crossing the street, entering their apartment. And over again, We find out that these African Americans are innocent, unarmed, legally armed, and not misusing their guns. The last murder by a law enforcement officer of an African American male that made national headlines was the killing of a security guard who was doing his job, holding down a killer and protecting the patrons. The whites who were taken alive, as indeed everyone should be, were mass murderers. Maybe if we present the situation in that way, some university administrators will get it. Maybe we can start a campaign responding to every university attempt at censorship with, "Stop, think, you are being a racist cop." Would that give them pause? Would they consider their knee-jerk, censor them first, fire them if they will not be silenced? Seriously, if administrators now consider a cuddly bear flying a kite, albeit with a Palestinian flag, as a possible endorsement of incitement to violence, how are they different from the most viciously racist cops? This is happening as Jewish students and faculty on many campuses are also expressing their frustration with administrators and staffs cracking down on criticism of Israel from within the Jewish community, while providing a platform for Israeli propagandists. Jewish Voice for Peace's report, Stifling Dissent, provides solid analysis of the divide within the Jewish American community over Palestine advocacy. At Northeastern University, for example, Hillel alienated and excommunicated students who established relationships with members of Students for Justice in Palestine, pushing both students and faculty to the margins or even off campus, while inviting Israeli activist Itamar Marcus to speak on campus and using that speech as a fundraiser for Hillel. Marcus is former president of the Central Fund of Israel, an organization highlighted in the New York Times article for using its tax exemption to fund settlement projects in the West Bank. Marcus himself lives in the Efrat settlement. The struggle to speak truth to power, the permission to narrate, as Edward Said put it, has been going on for decades, but has recently shifted from isolated individual cases to a national issue thanks to the visibility of faculty who openly challenge their censorship and unfair treatment, and the support of a few legal and civil rights organizations, i.e., Palestine Legal and the ACLU, have done much needed work to stem the assault on Palestine advocacy. It's time to elevate it one step further. Let's ask our administrators to stop and think before you censor, or be academia's racist cops. That was a Mondo Weiss report written by Nada Elia. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, which is an exploration of the Christian Evangelical Zionist movement, which is huge in the United States. The presentation is by Thomas Gedman. Before a conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C., it begins with his introduction.
Our next speaker is discussing the topic of Christian Zionism. For those of you who don't know, Christian Zionism is the belief that the establishment of the modern state of Israel in the Holy Land is the fulfillment of biblical prophecy and thus deserves unrelenting support from Christians. When President Trump announced in December his intention to declare Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, many attributed his decision to the power of Christian Zionists, who are a key Trump constituency, and have a powerful and devoted member in Vice President Mike Pence. But just how powerful the Christian Zionists are is up for debate, and we will address that today. There are also theological questions about Christian Zionism and the extent to which it is legitimate interpretation of Scripture and to the extent to which it is heretical. I like that word. And Finally, questions as to how it started, where is it going, and who is challenging the evangelical community. To discuss this today, we have Thomas Getman. He is a partner in a private consulting group that specializes in international, United Nations, and non-governmental organization affairs. He got his start in South Africa and fighting for justice there, and later discovered the Palestine issue. He has worked primarily, as many of you know, for World Vision, where he worked continuously for Palestinian issues in the West Bank and Gaza. I believe, yes. And with that, I will like to introduce him to discuss Christian Zionism.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks to the wonderful organization of our sponsoring groups and for your being here to discuss these important issues with us. As the resident theologian today, I must tell you that particularly this morning, I was reminded that we operate within a very secular climate, but we also operate in an aura of the creation ordinances. And sometimes that's forgotten. And I cut my eye teeth on human rights in the Middle East because the likes of Tutu and Boussac and Beresnaude and people like that said to me, if I really wanted to prove my bona fides in terms of human rights, I should turn my eyes to the Palestinians. And I really am grateful for that, because I was, truth be told, a complicit evangelical Zionist, like the polling data today showed, but unwittingly. I didn't even know what it meant. But living and working in the Middle East for 5 years to begin with, and now 20 years all told, we see that there is a breaking forth of history that is beyond our usual comprehension of things. It's good to be reminded as we seek reasons for hope that those who lay traps get their own feet ensnared. Those that do things in the dark have it come into the light. And there are things happening on college campuses today, university campuses today, because of the suffering of our sister from San Francisco State. What man means for evil, the transcendent order understands for good. So the topic today drives us to seek to understand the question today is helpful to comprehend that American Christians, in particular, speak in two theological languages when it comes to Israel and Zionism. We are living in a troubling culture with a culture war darkness as a nation, and this may help us understand how we arrived here. The great majority of mainstream Christians, that would be Catholics, Protestants, and Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, and even more than 20% now of the 100 million evangelicals are rooted in a 2,000-year orthodoxy that was quantified during the creedal debates of the 3rd century. It's not just religion we're talking about. It's not just creedal material we're talking about. We're talking about social justice. On the other hand, Zionism, both Jewish and Christian, is rooted theologically in a 19th and early 20th century minority belief, and in it, the Bible predicts 7 dispensations of history. A real stretch to do this kind of cherry-picking. Moving us toward the return of all Jews to Palestine, or more appropriately, Jews to all of Palestine, in order to hasten the day of the end times. You may have noticed recently there have been some predictions about when it was coming. I hope you got your stuff stored away. It's been popularized by the Left Behind fictional series. This view purports Christians suddenly disappear, presumably to heaven. A final apocalyptic war, Armageddon, occurs. against the evil Antichrist, and a thousand-year peaceful reign of the Messiah begins. Everyone is judged as to their faithfulness to God's plan, but ironically, two-thirds of all Jews are killed and the rest become Christians. The millennial reign, according to Zionists, began with 1948 and 1967. Zionism becomes dangerous when it aligns with empire and ethnic religious nationalism. Ethical guidance takes a back seat, especially with exceptionalism. This highly imaginative view is considered heresy in most of the theological circles. And it's no longer widely embraced by evangelicals, certainly not by rabbinic Jews or by main denomination Christians, unless it's without thought, without really knowing the issues. That's where our responsibility comes in. Even Billy Graham said he was agnostic about the end times when he declared it will all pan out in the end. But silence in the mainstream church has allowed Palestine to be defined by Zionists. It is the basis of Christian Zionism, about which a straightforward definition is offered by Dr. Don Wagner, a Presbyterian, former Zionist himself, when he states, "It is a movement within Protestant, now Catholic fundamentalism that understands the modern state of Israel as the fulfillment of biblical prophecy and thus deserving of political, financial, and religious support." Christian Zionism proceeded by 50 years and even influenced the emergence of Jewish Zionism. Surprise? When the British literalists cherry-picked biblical references to apply to a physical state for diaspora Jews, ultimately, they helped to bring about what their adherents promoted and now believe is that state brought through an act of God in 1948. This nationalistic perspective can be seen as a key to understanding the troubling geopolitical field fire fanned by the Jerusalem announcement by the U.S. president and the fawning, fumbling visit by the vice president. It explains the division of the house in Israel, which resulted in damaging replacement of rabbinic social justice Judaism with secular Jewish Zionism. Recent history shows the resulting marriage of convenience for joint image protection by the Jewish Christian lobby. So how did we arrive here? Especially at this crucial juncture, it's important to understand it. The 200-year progression of this history is at once instructive and frightening. We can see the consequences of rationalizing colonialization and partisan politics, influenced by religion, to exclude the rights of one group over another. The law of love is replaced by violence. South Africa, former director of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Georgetown professor Charles Villavicencio, explained, "It's the fault line running through Western civilization. The first century of the Common Era, the church was born, and the synagogue was transformed. In the midst of this issue, religions separating groups with the right of one group to dominate the other, or whether they bring humankind to the realization of our unity and connectedness. As children of the Father Abraham and recipients of his promise, to establish many nations." This is the central issue. The lobby writ large is the questionable combining of forces between the Israel government and American Christian Zionists. Our government and our church people are complicit in this furtive enterprise, sometimes unwittingly. AIPAC is successful as an agent of minority Gentile sentiment, not just Jewish support. And sadly, the majority, as you heard from me early, has been silent. We must stir them up. And I propose it is bad for Israel as well as America's place in the free world. It's destined for failure. It is important to see the progression of Christian Zionism's development. It has roots at least as far back as the 16th century European Reformations, The early literal readership of the local language translations like the King James Bible, later in Scofield reference editions, had footnotes and commentary that promoted dispensational Zionism. It led to several centuries of anti-Semite Jewish persecution, ultimately the Holocaust, and all the way to the mid-20th century best-selling fictional works of the late great Planet Earth and Left Behind. The modern movement can be traced to early 19th century with a group of eccentric British Christian restorationists lacking formal theological training. They began to lobby for Jewish return to Palestine and the necessary precondition for the second coming of Christ, or the first coming of the Messiah, as you wish. John Darby was their leader, and the Darbyists gained traction from the middle of the 19th century when Palestine became strategic to Britain, France, and Germany in their colonial interests in the Middle East. These Christian Zionists who preceded Jewish Zionism were some of Theodor Herzl's strongest advocates, and ironically were both clergy and lay people who embraced the anti-Semitic theology and genocidal images around racial nationalism. Herzl's appeal to the British leadership was in part on an understanding anger for what had happened to Jews in the previous centuries, but also undergirded by misinterpreted scriptures. In the early 20th century, evangelist Billy Sunday, D.L. Moody, and others promulgated the Scofield Bible dispensational point of view to convert people by employed end-of-the-world fear. As early as 1917, the British bartered away Palestine with the Balfour Declaration, and the 1919 American King Crane Report urged caution about Zionist intention of dispossession, but the report's attention to the local population was either ignored or buried by President Wilson for several years. This was concurrent with the Arab false appreciation that they would gain Palestinian liberation by their alliance with the Ottomans. Arthur Balfour and Lloyd George were predisposed toward Zionism in their support for a Jewish national home, but with mixed racist motives about white British superiority. Their primary goal was to advance British imperial interests with utilitarian politics. Zionism continued to reflect some of that strain into the middle of the last century and to today. After World War II, more urbane Billy Graham avoided the label Zionist with his approach, which stirred millions. He did not, however, instruct about the dangers of Zionism in the churches to which he sent his converts. Even with his anti-Semitic misstep recorded with Richard Nixon, fortunately, he founded Christianity Today magazine, a globally minded, modern, evangelical publication that reflected his social justice abolitionist roots and has had a series of progressive editors partnering with Anglican scholar, anti-Zionist John Stott, and the NGO-sponsored trips to the Holy Land. Sadly, his son Franklin hasn't taken the same path. The impact of the Holocaust in this era was a legitimate concern, and then coupled with the guilt about U.S. capping Jewish asylum and turning away refugees, the UN Partition Resolution of November of 1947 was supported by Harry Truman. He was influenced certainly by his dispensational beliefs, but likely even more by the looming re-election campaign considerations and the financial infusion from pro-Israeli donors. The fact was ignored that Palestinians, as the 66% majority, owned 90% of the land. Christian Zionism was encouraged when in 48 Israel was assumed to be the sign of God and his personal intervention with the anticipation of the end time battles of Armageddon, and was as well influenced by APAC's predecessor, American Zionist Council. It gained impetus after the return of Jews to what they called the eternal undivided capital in 67. Which encouraged the populist teaching of dispensational theology by Dallas Seminary and similar seminaries, especially throughout the South in the Bible Belt. The more secular Israeli Labor Party had few relationships with Christian Zionists prior to the election of Likud's Menachem Begin in 1977. Begin, however, saw the necessity of the theopolitical match made in heaven. Likud courted the relationship with leaders such as Falwell, Robertson, and other TV preachers who captured the TV time for most Christians, and from the booming fundamentalist Zionist churches in the South. In 1979, with great fanfare, Falwell was presented a private jet by Begin, purportedly to affirm the Israeli policies, such as their soon 1981 bombing of Iraq's nuclear site, but also to spread the Zionist action plan. The election of Ronald Reagan, who was converted to Christian Zionist beliefs, helped solidify Christian Zionism at the center of the Republican Party in the White House, along with several speakers of the House. Opposition began to be more public by well-known liberal ministers and scholars, and even John McCain called Falwell and Robertson agents of intolerance. Still, Jewish Zionists had few encounters with Christian Zionists before 2000, even with the assumption by Christians that the 67 war miracle was final proof to them for the return of Jesus. It took politics of necessity to drive the strange bedfellows together, helped, of course, by Jewish lack of faith in the Zionist-Christian distasteful end-time creed. 9/11 sealed the marriage. The glue was that they both feared and hated Muslims. This hastened the growth of the so-called evangelical Zionism. In this present era, and especially with the election of Trump, and the Republican Congress, an encouragement movement in opposition to Christian Zionism has grown among mainstream political and religious entities. This has helped us to battle complicity. Those who lay the traps will have their own feet caught. As the Zionist profile became more public through the pro-Israel lobby of Christians and Jews, especially through John Haggai's Kofi, Christians United for Israel, three factors were apparent. First, the lobby served to undermine peace and increase, even encourage violence. Second, their utterly biased and one-sided utterings and massive funding have been opposed by Jews as well as Christians. And finally, third, the United States is seen increasingly to be a party to injustice rather than an honest broker for a just settlement of the conflict. The lobby's goal to stand shoulder to shoulder for significant influence in Washington by portraying Israel in a positive light in public discourse is proving more difficult and counterproductive. The Israeli lobby is being seen as an agent of the foreign power, in part because of Mr. Netanyahu's debt demands and decline, thank God, and Mr. Trump's ignorance and intrusion. More open debate is happening on university campuses, as we've just heard, especially as BDS has caused panic efforts in Congress and Knesset to limit First Amendment freedoms. And print and broadcast media, pro-Israeli editorial, and news bias shows real signs of change. Greater understanding is occurring about faulty oppressive theology and excesses and American Christian complicity in illegal neocolonial activity. There is an increasing awareness of severe demonization of Palestinians, Muslims, and Christians. Treatment of other minorities within Israel and the region is stirring opposition, especially because of the horrors of Gaza, the expulsion of African refugees, and the church tax bank issues. Many more people, including the young, are traveling with alternative social justice agencies to the traditional Holy Land holy sites, but they're spending a lot more time than has been traditionally the way in the West Bank, talking to the Livingstones who are demanding liberation. The arc of history is being bent toward justice by young people. Polling and experience indicates that evangelicals, especially millennials, are more pro-immigrant, less Islamophobic, and increasingly concerned about the negative impact of occupation annexation. Appreciation is growing for and in solidarity with influential progressive and modern Zionists, for instance, Plus 972, Laura Friedman, Rabbis for Human Rights, and mainstream Israeli combatants for human rights as they seek help on their PTSD. Pilgrims, even now, amazingly, some enlightened progressive dispensationalists are embracing more of the true prophetic biblical declarations about responsibility toward the marginalized poor, blind, and oppressed, the strangers in the land. Genesis 12 has been the basis of much of Zionist propaganda, that God would bless those who bless you, to Abraham, and above all, the people you curse, he will curse. The fact is, that promise wasn't made to Israel, it was made to Abraham, the father of all of us. They forget that. There is a changing sensitivity. Increasingly, people are understood to be chosen, as in the old children's song, "All the Children of the World, Red and Yellow, Black and White." My evangelical colleagues now say Jews, Christians, and Muslims are precious in his sight. The more liberal and progressive social justice denominations and believers, including many Jews, align themselves with the 2006 statement on Christian Zionism by the Jerusalem patriarchs of the traditional faiths. They declared, quote, "We categorically reject Christian Zionist doctrines as false teaching that corrupts the Bible's message of love, justice, and reconciliation," end quote. And the American National Council of Churches adds, "The theological stance of Christian Zionism adversely affects justice and peace in the Middle East." Unusually, on February 22nd, just passed, in response to U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, 25 well-known senior evangelical leaders expressed concern, albeit too timidly in my view, about unprecedented actions that may jeopardize lives and future, may jeopardize lives and future security of the people of the Holy Land. I hope they can be more concerned about current Palestinian suffering, but it opens the door for more White House dialogue. Therefore, it is questionable how much contemporary American theology and electoral politicking and legislating are being driven extensively by heretical dispensational understanding of Eretz Israel. Further evidence of it being challenged is because of actions by evangelical organizations such as Sojourners, Evangelicals for Social Action, faith-based operational agencies who have some of their staff people in prison. These and other faith groups are partnering with J Street, Jewish Voice for Peace, New Israel Fund, operational agencies, as well as the think tanks such as Middle East Institute and the Foundation for Peace. Also, great films, God on Our Side, Road to Apartheid, Occupation of the American Mind, Nora's film, Gaza, Gaping Wound, Gaza in Context, etc. Social justice evangelicals are working to rehabilitate their brand, or frankly, to desert it if necessary, in order to differentiate further from the Haggis, Pences, and Moores of the world, which has potential for impacting the fall elections. Members of Congress who have expressed quiet opposition for Israeli policies are being more vocal regarding treatment of children, Betty McCollum's bill on child prisoners, MCs Price and Welch's, and 100 members' action on UNRWA, which is a questionable pursuit. And in conclusion, many prominent progressive leaders are helping to sharpen our thinking regarding Christian Zionists, for the God they portray looks to be militaristic, xenophobic, genocidist, and would not sufficiently be moral enough to conform to the Fourth Geneva Convention. So as God turned from love and grace to be a great ethnic cleanser, Martin Buber, the great ethicist, said in his declaration of opposition to Zionism, "Hatred is bound to ruin us. Guilt and complicity are twins hard to separate. Those who pull the trigger and those who pay for the guns are inextricably bound." Anglican theologian Naima Teik states, "We must oppose Christian Zionism by asserting one clear principle. Any religion that does not promote justice, truth, peace, love, forgiveness, and reconciliation among people has lost its rudder and is undeserving of respect. Their religion and their teachings are destructive rather than liberating force in the world. I would place Christian Zionists in this group," he says, "having seen their impact personally while living in Jerusalem and in other places in the world, I do too." Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. We have about 3 minutes for questions, so I'll shoot about maybe two of them to you, and if you could respond relatively quickly, that'd be appreciated. One person asks, "Can you say something about Israel's treatment of Palestinian Christians and Western Christian NGOs such as World Vision, where you previously worked. And another person asked, what does it say about Christians United for Israel, the largest Christian Zionist lobby, that their executive director is Ehud Barak's cousin and is not actually a Christian?
Well, that says a lot. I don't need to answer that. It shows, can I dare use the word evil, of the kind of collaboration that happens around a political issue rather than moral and ethical issues. On the first question, I believe the NGOs are being stifled. They're being shut up. They're being arrested as a cooling effort to scare our people. I think the NGOs generally are in the target big time, and some of our staff people are arrested for trumped-up charges that are just so counterintuitive as to be ridiculous. And talking to the lawyers about what happens to these people, an Israeli Jew, says we all together must speak out more about this atrocity, because these folks are innocent as the day is long, but the Israeli government finds them an easy target, and it can be used to stifle advocacy. And when marketing plays such an important role for operational agencies, or for churches for that matter, this has a huge impact. Enough said. Thanks.
You have been listening to Thomas Getman speaking before the conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C. Before we sign off this morning, I would like to add a recording of a short interview with independent journalist Max Blumenthal. It has to do with Interpol recognizing Palestine by allowing it to become a member, giving it a kind of state recognition. Of course, Israel fights back whenever there is such a recognition of Palestine, as it did when UNESCO also recognized them. Here is that interview with Max Blumenthal.
Israel is threatening retaliation after Interpol voted to accept Palestine as a state member. The Israeli Prime Minister even accused the Palestinian leadership of hindering any chance of peace in the troubled region. In fact, Interpol joins a long list of international organizations to recognize Palestine's statehood. The territory declared independence in late 1998 and was recognized by dozens of countries, including every Arab state, the Soviet Union, and its allies. More states recognized the country over the next few decades. Now, a breakthrough for Palestine came in 2011 when it was accepted to UNESCO. And a year after that, UN General Assemblies, they upgraded Palestine status from non-state entity to non-member state. So to talk more about all of this, we're being joined now by investigative journalist and author Max Blumenthal. Hey, Max, good to see you on Friday.
Good to see
you. So real quick, first let's take a listen to Israeli PM Benjamin Netanyahu, to his reaction on Interpol's move.
This attempt is part of an ongoing Palestinian campaign to continue the conflict with Israel inside professional international bodies in a way that disrupts these bodies' work. The Palestinian diplomatic warfare will not go unanswered.
All right, Max, you just saw that. What are your thoughts? You're laughing, I see.
Yeah, I'm kind of laughing because, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu gets upset any time a Palestinian sneezes or coughs or has, turns in his bed at night. So it's not really, it's consistent with general opposition, not only to any Palestinian diplomatic moves, but to the very existence of the state of Palestine. That's one reason why Israel is upset, that Interpol is one other agency that confers upon the Palestinian Authority the legitimacy of statehood. The other reason, which I think is more interesting and more revealing, is that there are red notifications that countries who participate in Interpol can put out, and that allows them to track, oppressive states will track dissidents, but they'll also track international criminals. The Palestinian Authority could use a red notification to put out an alert for an Israeli war criminal like Tzipi Livni, who is implicated in war crimes in the Gaza Strip when she was foreign minister between 2008 and 2009. And actually, when she landed in London fairly recently, she had to leave because she was told to report to the British police because of universal jurisdiction. So this is really what Israel's worried about. And it's basically a tacit admission that they know that they have some blood on their hands and that they don't want to be held accountable.
Sort of their free pass has been taken away by a little bit by this.
They fear that, certainly. Of course, the U.S. is there to protect them and also opposes Palestinian participation in Interpol.
Speaking of U.S., the ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, appeared to apparently just recently break with the longstanding U.S. Consensus on a two-state solution.
Yeah.
And he did this in a recent interview with Israel's Walla News. Friedman said, quote, "I believe settlements are a part of Israel," and cited UN Resolution 242. Does 242 really back up Friedman's contention that really he said that they're occupying 2% of the West Bank? Is there really evidence to support that?
Yeah, obviously not. I mean, this is something you hear from the settlement movement in Israel, and you hear it from the governing Likud party of Benjamin Netanyahu. It's absurd. And what he's referring to is just parts of area, 2% of the population that is Jewish who lives in Area C, because it's divided under the Oslo Accords into A, B, and C. Area A are the main Palestinian population centers, but those centers are occupied. Qalqilya, for example, the city of Qalqilya is in Area A, and it's one of those areas that David Friedman thinks isn't occupied. The problem is the city of Qalqilya is completely surrounded by the Israeli separation wall on all sides, and so it's losing its population, because imagine living in a walled-in city. It's like something Montgomery Burns would have created in a Simpsons dystopia. So that's the reality. But the most interesting thing to me about Friedman is this is a guy who has business ties to the settlement enterprise. He's a Trump appointee. He really represents the hard-line right-wing pro-settlement ideology. And he is basically saying that there's no such thing as a Palestinian state, which explodes the whole peace process. It explodes the concept of a two-state solution.
Right.
And so you not only have, you know, the Palestinian Authority getting upset, the state, U.S. State Department is upset at its own appointee in Jerusalem.
But Heather Nauert, the former reporter turned State Department spokesperson, she says that his comments don't actually reflect the administration's beliefs. What do you make of that?
Well, the strategy since 1967 for the kind of mainstream pro-Israel elements in Washington and Washington itself has been to never set timetables on negotiations and to basically say we're working towards a two-state solution and a Palestinian state while allowing Israel to continue building settlements. Since then, they've moved something like 500,000 to 600,000 settlers into the West Bank. What Friedman has done is essentially saying there's no two-state solution. Those Palestinians that are in the West Bank are now under the control of Israel, and they have no rights to vote, no civil rights, no human rights, and he's essentially officializing apartheid, which is itself a crime at the UN.
Is what Friedman saying sort of like a Freudian slip? Is that really what the administration thinks then?
Well, this is what the right wing of the administration wants to do, which is a one-state solution, but if you live in Israel-Palestine, you're in a one-state reality. So I think, and a lot of people who have strategized about this think that it's time to recognize that one-state reality and move towards a binational state with equal rights. And the way forward is to recognize that Israel has enacted a system of apartheid, and that means eliminating this concept of Palestinian statehood, which is a total fantasy, and recognizing the reality on the ground where you have close to 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank alone in East Jerusalem who have no rights.
All right. As always, Max, thanks for sharing your expertise on the subject. Investigative journalist and author Max Blumenthal.
Thanks for having me.
That was an interview with independent journalist Max Blumenthal following the recognition of Palestine by Interpol. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
The rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Lately, the media is full of images of cheering campaign supporters as candidates vie for their party's nominations. But many have noticed that the candidates of either party who dare to make substantive critique of the political economy from either the right or the left have been conspicuous by their absence in major corporate media outlets and have been marginalized by their own party leaderships as well. Their critiques and views, it seems, have strayed too close to the heart of the system. A Robin Hood in reverse affair where the power of the state is used to transfer wealth from the many at the bottom of the economic pyramid to those at the top, belying the rhetoric of free markets. This week, the program is devoted to a recent talk by an award-winning investigative reporter who has delved into how the laws and regulations make this possible, as well as the spin and misleading language that serves to obfuscate what is actually happening. David K. Johnston has a long career as an investigative journalist and joined the New York Times in 1995. Recently, his work has focused on the subject of taxation. His most recently published book, Free Lunch: How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill, is an exposé of hidden subsidies, rigged markets, and what has been called corporate socialism. It follows on his previous book, Perfectly Legal: The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else, which was a New York Times bestseller. Johnston received the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for Beat Reporting for, quote, his penetrating and enterprising reporting that exposed loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, which was instrumental in bringing about reforms, close quote. In his long career, he's worked for various major daily papers around the country and studied economics at the University of Chicago and elsewhere. He now lives near Rochester, New York, where he spoke on February 16th at an event sponsored by the Rochester Labor Lyceum, an organization that has presented public talks and debates on topics of labor and social justice since 1897. Here's David K. Johnston.
My goodness, thank you for all coming. This is terrific. I've sometimes flown across the country and had 25 people turn up, so I appreciate this. You know, 28 years ago, Ronald Reagan asked the question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? I'm here to ask the question, are you better off than you were in 1980? I'm going to help you remember. Now, on one level, the country is much better off. More than half the national wealth has been created since 1980. In real terms, we are more than twice as wealthy today as we were in 1980. Per person, adjusted for inflation, for every dollar the economy put out in 1980, it is putting out roughly $1.70 today. So how come you're not all flush with cash, free of debt, have better fringe benefit plans that you had back then, better health care plans, and better retirement plans? Where's the beef? Remember that from 1980? Where's the beef? Where'd all that money go? What the hell happened? That's what Free Lunch is about. Free Lunch is a book that people who don't want you to hear this message start calling me a leftist and a Marxist and an enemy of capitalism. It is a book about, in fact, defending free markets, and which cites throughout it classic conservative virtues taken from Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, and whose name is invoked continually in this era for our economic policies, because he's the one who figured out that it is markets that create economic growth, not acts of charity. The Bible, and of all people, Andrew Mellon. And if I forget in the next 75 minutes while I talk, or 70 minutes, is not Andrew Mellon, please make sure somebody asks me that when you ask questions. All right? Well, go back to 1980 for a moment. Let's remember what happened. America had come through an era in which we had unbelievable prosperity driven by a stock market bubble and speculation in the late 1920s. The top 10%, the top 1%, the top half of 1%, the top 10th of 1%, the top 100th of 1% all had growing share of the income. And then we had the crash. And we had all those years of economic turmoil and trouble. And coming out of World War II, we have this notion that the war wasn't over. There was a Cold War. A whole lot of people who wanted to go invade Russia, just like Napoleon did, and probably would have had similar success. But during the period after the war, we had a government with bipartisan agreement that focused on developing and nurturing a middle class, on creating economic stability in people's lives. We had the GI Bill. Enormous explosion in the number of men with college degrees. Enormous explosion. We had VA loans, GI loans, 30-year mortgages that allowed people to buy their own houses and finance them over time and put some economic stability in their lives. The movie they show every year at Christmas by Frank Capra, It's a Wonderful Life, that was a very good depiction of life in the 30s, where, you know, cruel old Mr. Potter rented all the property, and you had to live in a crummy apartment unless somehow you could put the money together through the building and loan, as they called it, to build your own house. Things went along very well. We had enormously high tax rates. The highest marginal tax rate in the 1950s was 91%. However, you should know that it only applied to capital income, not wage income. Capital income meaning gains from selling something at a higher price than you paid for it, dividends, interest, and almost nobody paid it. Ronald Reagan asserts that he paid it. Everybody else hired a good tax lawyer and paid less. Did it? Well, for the bottom 90% of Americans, based on tax data, incomes in this country peaked in 1973. That's 35 years ago. 35 years ago, I had little children and black hair. And I weighed 100 pounds less. 35 years ago, man, you could pay a house off with a 30-year mortgage and have 5 more years to put money away. That's a long period of time. In the year 2005, that's the latest year we have data for, the average income of the bottom 90% of Americans was, ready for this, $74 a week less in real terms than it was in 1973. That's almost $4,000. And what happened in 1973, anybody remember? Oil. It was our first experience with the role of oil in gasoline lines and what could happen and how dependent we had become on oil. Well, the economy stopped growing. We got stagflation. One of the buzzwords of the 70s, stagflation. Inflation, stagnant growth. And so Mr. Reagan came along in 1980, aided somewhat by the fact that our embassy had been overrun in Iran, and ran for office on this argument, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And Mr. Reagan famously said, government is the problem. And he told us that markets were the solution. Now, Ronald Reagan was a very smart guy. He played a sort of dumb, ambling character to the public. But he was a very smart guy. But he was not a detail guy. He was not a Jimmy Carter. He wasn't a policy wonk. He thought about big issues. And the big issues he saw were bringing down the commies in Moscow, building up the military, and cutting taxes, and this new word that was introduced into our lexicon, deregulation. Well, so what's happened? It's been 28 years. That's more than enough time for us to make some assessment of what took place. We were all told government would get smaller. Taxes would be less. We'd be better off. We'd make more money. None of those things have happened. Government as a share of the economy has not changed. The only thing that's changed is that government has gone from taxing and spending to taxing and borrowing and spending. To the point where this year, approximately all of the individual income taxes that you have withheld from your income stream from January through the end of April will just go to pay interest on the national debt. When Mr. Reagan took office, the national debt was less than $1 trillion, just about $1 trillion. When Mr. Bush leaves office, it will be roughly $10 trillion. 86% of the income that we put in the tax system comes from wages and deferred wages, a pension, a 401k plan. Those are deferred wages. Well, think about what that means then. When the government borrows money, it is explicitly taxing people on their labor to pay interest to capital. It is an explicit transfer from labor to capital. And so the more the government borrows, the better off the people with capital are. Any of you watch Jane Austen movies or read Jane Austen's book? She's, after all, the most read writer in history, I'm told. Well, there are all these discussions about, oh, Mr. Darcy has 10,000. And Mr. So-and-so, he has 5,000. What they're talking about is the amount of capital they had that they loaned to the state and the annual pounds they collected in interest. Well, that's what we're doing. We've created a system here to tax you on your labor or your deferred labor income to funnel money to capital. Now, we've done something related to this through government policy. We've adopted a whole host of policies under the guise of deregulation. Now, deregulation to most people means, well, the government's going to get out of the way. We're just going to have a free market. You constantly, if you turn on the radio, if you turn to CNBC, if you read the Wall Street Journal editorial page, you will constantly hear free markets, free markets, free markets. There is no such thing. Everything has rules. Baseball has rules on how many stitches there are in the baseball. There are rules on where your car has to stop when you come to an intersection. And if you cross that line, you can get a ticket. Everything has rules. So we didn't get deregulation. We got new regulation. And we got new regulation written by, on behalf of, and serving the interests of the people who are subject to the regulations. And I'll come back to this in a minute. Now, another thing that's happened is that we have created the most inefficient, inexpensive healthcare system in the world. In Free Lunch, I cite as my source, what I'm about to tell you, the CIA. Now, the CIA may be doing a lousy job of gathering real-time intelligence about perceived enemies, but they are really good at analyzing things like train schedules, how much coal is being mined in Outer Mongolia, and things like that. They're really good at that. Nobody questions their ability. So what does the CIA say about our healthcare system in the CIA fact book? Well, by many measures of healthcare, we rank below Cuba and with such leading countries of the world as Croatia. And yet, we spend far more money than the Europeans, the Canadians, the Japanese, the New Zealanders, and the Australians on our healthcare system. We spend more money in absolute terms. We spend more money per person. And yet, one out of seven Americans, mostly poor people, does not have health care. And the constant cry is socialized medicine. That, of course, is what every member of Congress has. It's what the President of the United States has. It's what every government employee has. It is what everybody who reaches 65 has. Now, the other day, you may have heard President Bush say, you know, this isn't true that people can't get health care. You can always go to the emergency room. Forget the economics of that. Now we'll go back to President Bush's knowledge of economics later on. The fact is that I was sitting on an airplane the other day. I spent an enormous amount of time in airplanes traveling around the country. And the person next to me said, I don't understand all this about people that have health care. I mean, I said, well, what if you get cancer? And they said, well, if you get cancer, the government takes care of you. I said, you're right. The government will provide you with free health care if you don't have it, if you get cancer. Do you know when? Well, when they find out you have cancer. I said, no. When you get to what's called stage three and become totally disabled. In other words, when it's more likely than not that you will die. That's when our government suddenly says, oh, we will provide health care for you. Now, if health care as a business worked, I would be the first guy to say this is terrific. I was introduced as a reporter for a newspaper. I'm also the chairman of the board of a little family company. It's a pipsqueak company, $2 million of revenue. We manage hotels. We're about to double our business. I have a lot of ambitions for this little company my oldest son and I run. But we have a healthcare system, if it worked as a business, would be great. But, you know, we used to have another model that should tell us why it wouldn't work. In the 1800s, we had fire insurance, not the kind you have today. In the 1800s, you hired an independent corporation to fight a fire if your house or your business caught fire. So my house is just fine, but my neighbor's house catches fire. My fire insurance company is at the end of the block. His is 2 miles away. My fire insurance company won't come. They won't fight the fire. They're not there to fight his fire. His house is fully engulfed by the time his company gets there. And now the fire takes my house because it's so hot, and we both lose our houses. It did not take long. It took about a decade for people to figure out this was a stupid system. And so what did we get? You know that we have socialized fire departments?
Yes.
By the way, we also have socialized police departments and socialized kindergarten and socialized parks and socialized roads. Now, to some people, this is an anathema. Milton Friedman, the great economist, from whose phrase and whose popularizing of the idea that there's no such thing as a free lunch, I took the title of my book, said, you know, people have this idea we're a society. We're not a society. We're 300 million people who just occupy the same geography. Really? I mean, does anybody here think that? Oh, okay, well, there's always one in every crowd. I think almost everywhere in the world experience has shown we're social animals. Mr. Friedman, who was Barry Goldwater's campaign advisor in 1964, wanted to eliminate all public parks. All public parks. The only things he was willing to concede were like small urban parks because it's impossible to efficiently put up a toll gate and control who enters and charge them. And God forbid some little child somewhere goes on a swing they didn't pay for. I, in free lunch, examine, well, what happens if we think of ourselves as a society? If we have rules that grease the wheels of commerce, that make things easier, that result in a well-educated population. We've all had the experience of going to buy something from a store clerk who functionally illiterate. McDonald's and other companies have put little icons on the cash register because we've cut spending on schools. As a young man, I mentioned in this book from the inner city of Rochester, I've been helping with college, and I kept trying to help him learn how to read. And one day, he suddenly tells me about Moby Dick. And I thought, well, that's astonishing that he could read Moby Dick, because he couldn't read all these much easier things I gave him. And he said, oh, I didn't read Moby Dick. I said, what'd you do? He says, well, they showed the movie. I said, well, what did you read? And I knocked off some novels. And he went, no, all they did all through high school. We never read a book. They just showed movies. This apparently has gone on all over the country. It should be an enormous scandal. And yet, nothing about it. Now, one of the most far-reaching things that's happened in our economy are rules and laws that force you to pay taxes that never get to government. Taxes that are instead used for the benefit of wealthy people. The wealthiest family in America are the Waltons. They control Walmart. They're worth, as a family, more than $100 billion. Well, according to one of their spokesmen, when they build a new Walmart store, in about one in three cases, they try to get the following deal. The sales tax you pay at the cash register never goes to the government. Now, they don't literally get to put it in their pocket. That would be too simple. Instead, the money is turned over to a government agency which buys bonds, which bought the land, which built the building, which leases it for virtually nothing to the Walmart company through a subsidiary that's in a state that has no state taxes, so they don't have to pay any state taxes in your state. And when the bonds are paid off, they own the store free and clear, purchased for them by you. Not because of the market, but because they got this special deal. Now, there are two ways to think about this. The first one is the obvious one. This means that your police department, your fire department, your schools, your libraries are not getting those tax dollars. The argument made is, well, but they wouldn't get them anyway because this is what's called tax increment financing. Would anybody think that tax increment financing means the sales tax you pay doesn't get to the government? That give you a clue as to what it is? No. Well, for that theory to be true, one of two things has to happen. Either the population and the wealth of a community grows and there's more spending, so it may work in a rapidly growing community, but then the market should provide the demand for the new store. Or every time a new grocery store opens in towns, if you're a Tops customer, you go buy a can of soup there, and then you go to the new market and buy a second one, right? We all do that. Sure. It's a phony theory. And by the way, they try to get a second deal that they usually get. Exemption from property taxes for 7 to 10 years. So you're paying these heavy, heavy property taxes here, and there are profitable businesses that aren't. I calculated from their own public statement how much over a period of, it's in the book, but I think it's 15 years, the Waltons paid, the Walmart company paid in property taxes compared to a homeowner who makes $50,000 a year. And if you were paying at the rate that they are, your property tax bill would be $10 a month, $120 a year. No wonder they're profitable. But remember I said there were two ways to think about this. Here's the second one. You went into business. You own a little store. And you've used your own money, your own hard work. You've built up this enterprise. You've invested in it. You haven't sucked dry of capital because you needed to keep the business going. And suddenly, your own town fathers, your own county legislature or supervisors, your own state legislature give this national competitor all this money to open up across the street from you. An enormous subsidy. And one of the stories I tell in free lunch is about a guy named Jim Weeknecht, who lives in the Poconos. He had a little outfitting club for hunters and fishermen. Tiny store, 2,100, 2,200 square feet. Six or seven employees. He made enough money that his wife, Julie, could stay home and raise their three kids. And to Jim Weeknecht, that was just fine. That was all the success he cared for. And then one day, in this little town of 4,100 people, he hears that Cabela's is going to come to town. Cabela's sells the same stuff, hunting and fishing gear. And they want $32 million. And here's how much $32 million is to that town. It is more than the entire city budget for 10 years. It is enough money to buy every family in that town a car. It's about $24,000 per family. And Weeknecht says, this is madness. He also says, you know, if I had $1 million from City Hall, I could build like a really successful business. Of course, if I went down to City Hall and said, give me $1 million, they'd laugh at me. They'd throw me out of here. But they gave Cabela's $32 million because Cabela said, if we build this store in the middle of the Poconos, people will come from New York and Connecticut and Washington, D.C. and Western Pennsylvania, and they're all going to drive, and there are going to be hotels built and restaurants. And somebody said, well, wait a minute, you're not building down our historic little downtown on the side of the freeway that nobody stops at. You're going to build on this pad across the way, a mile and a half away. And somehow they came up with the brilliant idea that, well, they'd just run a free trolley. So after you bought your hunting and fishing gear, you could go over to the little downtown. And Jim Winkneck said, why would you drive a day or two to buy a fishing reel when you can get everything Cabela sells except rifles out of their catalog? But here's the real rub about it. How did Jim Winkneck survive as a tiny business all these years? He kept a Cabela's catalog at the cash register in the front of his store. And whenever anybody would question the price he wanted to charge for a hunting bow or a jacket or a fishing rod, he would pull out the Cabela's catalog and say, well, see, my price is lower. He was more efficient. In fact, many times local sellers are more efficient and charge lower prices. That's why in New York City, if you go down to the bargain district on the Lower East Side, any day of the week except Saturday, you can buy things for a lot less than anywhere else in the city. They're very efficient operators. Well, there's another device that's used to suck money out of you whether you take part in it. How many people in this room have a burglar alarm? About 1 in 5, maybe. People agree? 1 in 10? Nationally, 1 in 5 houses has a burglar alarm. Now, that's kind of odd because your odds of being burglarized today are half what they were in 1980. Crime has gone down, and the population has increased. So your chances of being burglarized are half what they were in 1980. But the burglar alarm business has exploded. Now, you've all seen these ads on TV. There's that cute little Hollywood beautiful mother. Now, Hollywood's an amazing place. They think Ernest Borgnine is an ugly man. There's this mother standing there with her little ones gathered around, and suddenly they show a guy at the front door. You know, he's got a Bowie knife in his mouth. And it's aimed at the head of the household, the father, that he should be worried about this. And then suddenly you hear this sound, and the lights come on, and the narrator in the ad says, and because you bought a burglar alarm, the police are on their way. Well, that's a description of a $2 billion a year subsidy. Because when the police go to check out that burglar alarm, it costs money. On average, it costs $50. Tyco, the center of the Wall Street scandals, gets one quarter of that subsidy, $500 million a year of free labor. Now, some of you are undoubtedly saying to yourself, wait a minute, the police should respond to burglar alarms. That's a proper function of the police. Well, let's think about that for a minute. 4 out of 5 houses don't have a burglar alarm. So they're being taxed to provide a service that only 1 out of 5 houses gets. Secondly, studies by the Justice Department show that having a dog, even a golden retriever, is about equal to a burglar alarm in keeping burglars at bay. Third, the average burglary takes 5 minutes. The average police response to a burglar alarm takes about a half an hour. They virtually never arrest anybody. They arrest at 1/10 the rate of patrol officers in patrol cars, which is itself a very inefficient way to do policing. We've all been accustomed to it because of long history, but it's not a useful use of your tax dollars. They've done experiments where they just remove all the police cars and crime doesn't change. Now, I am not saying you shouldn't be able to have a burglar alarm. You got a burglar alarm, that's fine. But let's have the market pay for the system. The burglar alarm companies typically charge $29 or $30 a month for burglar alarm service, which really means they put a little device about this long, size of my little finger, on your telephone line, and if the burglar alarm is tripped, it sends a signal to a computer technician. It comes up with information. He makes a phone call. If you don't answer or you don't answer and give the right answer his questions with the right answers, they call the police. The profit margin on the burglar alarm monitoring business, according to the industry's own statistics, is 77%. Now, just to make sure you understand the perspective on that, business as a whole in the United States counts, depending on the economy, 9 to 11 cents, tilted toward 11 cents out of each dollar as profit. This is off the wall profitable because there's no expense. This is what I call economic pollution. It is no different than environmental pollution. In environmental pollution, the smokestack or the drain pipe takes the company's toxic wastes and makes the rest of us endure it through dirty air, unsafe water, or some other negative effect. And what these companies are doing is taking their real costs of operating their business and throwing it off, polluting the economy, and making you pay their costs. And of all the things I've written about in Free Lunch, by the way, the most sustained attack I'm getting is from the burglar alarm industry. They're getting letters posted. They're calling every radio and TV show I show up on. They never tell people they're from the industry, though. Only because somebody knew who some of the names were did I find out that these were really people in the industry. Now, here we are in Rochester, New York, an hour and a half from Niagara Falls, with all of that electricity being generated. And yet, you know, we get virtually none of it unless you live in Fairport. And the state of New York is about to make a deal with the oldest aluminum plant in America. It may have finished the deal by now. To sell them discounted electricity for 30 years. It is the functional equivalent of the state of New York writing a check to this one company for $5.6 billion. You think, I don't care how big your company is, you think if the government handed you $5.6 billion, you might make a nice profit? You're not competing in the market. You're saying that little businesses and all the small manufacturing things that have gone away because of various costs around here, including electricity, aren't going to have that power. So this one company, and the cost of saving those jobs is roughly $148,000 each. Now, this is something we do all over the country. And who do we give that money to? Well, last year, Warren Buffett owns Geico Insurance through his holding company. You know, the cavemen and the little lizard. Over in Buffalo, where they have the highest urban unemployment in the state of New York, they gave his company a gift of $100 million to create a call center. These are not jobs that pay a lot of money. People who are going to deal with problems people have with their insurance. The Buffalo News ran a feature about the way to get a career going and become an executive is to start out working in a call center. We all laugh and think that's silly. Guess who owns the Buffalo News? Warren Buffett. And it didn't create any jobs. Why? Because a Canadian firm that owned a similar center with about as many workers as Mr. Buffett intends to have shut down just as his was opening up. And it didn't do anything for the high unemployment rate in downtown Buffalo because they built it in one of the whitest suburbs of Buffalo, a place with virtually no bus service from the inner city. And this is part of a pattern. Donald Trump, last year, or in 2006, I guess it was in 2006, got $89 million for his casinos from a tax the state of New Jersey imposes specifically for the poor. Now, the last time I looked, Donald Trump was not holding himself out to be impoverished. In fact, he's suing one of my colleagues at the New York Times for writing in a book that he's not a billionaire. When I wrote that he had a negative net worth of $600 million in 1990, he probably would have liked to sue me. The problem was that I had his own personal financial net worth statement that showed what he said he was worth and his bankers said he was worth. One way to think about this is at least at that time, you were probably worth more than Donald Trump. All throughout our society, we are creating rules. Rules that the news media have either not written about or written about with an utter lack of clarity. Tax increment financing. That are taking money out of your pocket. Lots of money. And giving it to rich people and large corporations, even when you don't do business with them. How many of you know that the Rhino Stadium, which you've been reading about, is in trouble? You know who's been paying the bond interest on those? We have. We. when Tom Fry was on a citizens committee to look at the viability of this project, he kept being denied information. And finally, he just said, I just have one question. All I want to know is, how much ticket revenue? How much did you get from actual paying fans? And they wouldn't say. So you and I are paying for this. Now, some people argue that this is essentially Joe Sixpack's government subsidy. Government gives money to art museums, not much. It gives money to live theater like Jiva. I'm on the board of Jiva. I think we get about 1% of our budget from government. But that's the argument that's made. But I want you to think about the size of these things. George Steinbrenner is having a new Yankee Stadium built in the Bronx. Initially, he insisted there was no subsidy. Then the New York Independent Budget Office said, well, it's at least $200 and some million. Then it went to 3-something, and then 4-something. We now know it's over $600 million, and we don't know all the terms of the deal. The Mets have an almost identical deal. Here's what we do know, because Wayne Barrett of the Village Voice dug this out. He's regarded by many people as the best local reporter in New York City. Rudy Giuliani gave the Mets and the Yankees $25 million each to lobby government to get subsidies. So you are being taxed to give money to these people to argue against your interest. But that's not the biggest deal. The really outrageous one is the Washington Nationals. When the Montreal Expos were transferred to Major League Baseball's owners, and then the franchise was moved to Washington, Major League Baseball sold the team for $450 million. Roughly, the other baseball team owners made a doubling of their profit because they had about $240 million in the deal. Well, a $450 million investment, that sounds like a big investment. A lot of jobs, a lot of money. Well, except the city of Washington, D.C., one of the poorest cities in the country, the city of Washington, D.C. is giving them a stadium worth $611 million. And they let the owners have the naming rights to the stadium. So it'll be called something like, you know, we have Frontier Field here. That's worth $400 million. Let's see. 611, 400, that's a billion plus. Cost of the team, $450 million. Oh, my God. We paid these guys over $500 million to buy the team. Holy mackerel. They don't have any money in the deal. Kind of like the Rhinos deal, as best anybody can tell. And maybe, because nobody has ever asked the question, like the Fast Ferry deal. If you look at Hevesy's audit, you look at the lawsuit Dutch Schultz bought, everybody stops the minute you get to the end of the government's accounting, and nobody's issued subpoenas and said, we want to see your books on the other side. We want to know what happened to the money that you got. Where'd it go? It's public money. If you lost a lot of money, fine. You made an investment and failed. But if, in fact, you got rich off this deal, we ought to know about it, even if we can't get it back. Well, let me tell you how George Bush made his fortune. George Bush is among the 1 in 1,000, actually about the 1 in 600 wealthiest people in America. He's not that wealthy. He's worth about $15 million. May sound like a lot of money to you, but in the world of wealth, that's nothing. Okay? I point out in the book that Forbes magazine says we have one billionaire here in Rochester. I went around and interviewed a lot of people and concluded that there are at least 4, maybe 7, and I've since had 2 leading citizens in town come talk to me and suggest that there probably are 9 billionaires living in the Rochester area. There are absolutely 4. Well, George Bush was a tax shelter salesman. You know, you hear all these stories. He had oil and gas drilling operations in Midland, Texas. What that really means is he was selling tax shelters. That's what people do who buy these things. And he was lousy at it. This is work that requires intense attention to detail. And whether you love George Bush or you hate George Bush, I think everybody knows this man is not, you know, he's not Jimmy Carter. Probably would have done really well if he had gone into that business. In addition, of course, this was when, by his own admission, he was drinking wildly. And as I point out in the book in a sort of backhanded way, he's admitted that up until 1974, he had another problem. Well, one day, a guy named Eddie Childs, 89 years old. He's looking at the clock and realizing his time is coming to an end. He owns the Texas Rangers baseball team. It's a little money-losing hobby. His kids don't want it. So he needs to unload this thing to straighten up his affairs. He puts it up for sale. Some out-of-towners are going to buy it. Immediately an uproar somehow arises in Texas. The Texans must buy this. We can't have outsiders buying our Texas Rangers. Up steps George W. Bush. Happens to have a father with a very interesting address in Washington and a golden Rolodex. And he puts together a group of investors who live in places like Beverly Hills, New York City, and Westchester County, and Connecticut. And they buy the team. And he tells them, listen, this is a really sweet deal. All we have to do is get a new stadium. Now, these guys, some of the guys who invest in steel are billionaires. Some of them are movie makers. George Bush had invested with two of these guys in a movie that's been described as the most bloody, vicious movie to ever come out of Hollywood, The Hitcher, starring Rutger Hauer. Big story about it in the L.A. Times. And George Bush was an investor in that film with two of the owners of the Rangers. And Bush told his partners, all we have to do is get a stadium built. Now, these guys could have built their own stadium. They've got deep pockets. They got plenty of money. They can go to a bank and have no trouble, but they didn't want to do that. Instead, they financed a special election held on an odd date in January. They hired a group of political consultants. It turned out to be Democrats, by the way, because all of the things I'm describing here are bipartisan in their nature. And this election passes, and they raise the sales tax in Arlington, Texas, a city of about 300,000 people midway between Fort Worth and Dallas. That money is then used to finance bonds to build a ballpark. And by the way, it's a gorgeous ballpark, just fantastic ballpark. Now, in a market economy, and President Bush is a big promoter, he says, of market economies, you want to build something, you go into the market and start assembling pieces of land. And the person who holds out, who becomes the last person to sell, often gets an incredible, extraordinary price. All throughout my career, I've read stories about somebody who owned, you know, a one-foot-wide strip of land somewhere that was needed to finish a deal, and they got $10 million for it. If you go to Las Vegas and go to the Mirage, in the middle of the parking lot of the Mirage, you will see an apartment building owned by a guy named Mike Flores. And in my first book, Temples of Chance, back in 1992, I wrote about this. He knew that they were going to need this land to build the Mirage, and he waited and waited for the market forces and figured he'd make a killing, and one day they offered him $1 million. And he said, wait a second, I'm making $120,000 a year out of this building. If I bought bonds, I'd lose half my income. You got to pay me $5 million. And Steve Wynn said, okay, we'll just build a parking lot around you. We don't care. We'll leave a little access road for you. And so to this day, in the middle of that parking lot, there's that building, and he never got his money. He took a risk in the market. He made the wrong bet. That's not what George Bush did. He got the government to go after the land he coveted and to seize it by government's power of eminent domain, which comes from the Constitution. Now, the Constitution says land seized for public purposes, which most of us tend to think about as roads, military bases, saving a swamp so that there's fish growing out in the ocean or in the river. But the Supreme Court has held that public purposes also include economic development. And just compensation, the requirement in the Constitution, is a synonym for discount, really deep discount. Most people just took what they could get and sold out. One family fought back. A lot of people in this room are old enough to remember Curtis Mathis televisions in the 50s.
Right.
That's the family that held out. They didn't want to sell their horse ranch. They went to court. A jury awarded them six times what the city said their land was worth, plus interest. Six times. Well, the subsidy for this deal, according to the public records and Ray Hutchison, a Republican insider, the husband of Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, Republican of Texas, and a personal friend of George Bush, who was the lawyer on the deal and who is the leading authority on municipal bond finance in Texas. He told me the subsidy was worth $202.5 million. When the team was sold, the profit reported by the investors, George Bush and the others, was $164 million. Let's see, subsidy $202 million, gain, oh, What happened to that $38 million? That's why subsidies don't work. They didn't capture it. George Bush, the NBA president, did not add $1 to the value of that team. Only the taxpayers did. Now, President Bush has always said this was a win-win for everybody. Well, let's think about that for a minute. The vast majority of people in this country never go to a baseball game. A vast majority of people in Arlington, Texas never go to a baseball game. But everybody was taxed. Little children who took the money they made from their allowance or from babysitting or mowing lawns and went to buy crayons or Nintendo games or whatever, they were taxed to give money to George Bush and his partners, all rich men. Fundamental to all of the things I've been talking about is that we have a government that has changed from the era after World War II up till 1980 of developing and nurturing a middle class, creating stability, creating broad prosperity, to a government whose de facto policy, that is, its unstated but actual policy, is to take from the many to give to the few. That's the case I argue in free lunch. Now, there was a review of my book in the New York Times a week ago Sunday that said, well, that's just not true. We soak the rich to help people at the bottom. Net transfers in the United States of cash flows, top to bottom, 3% of the economy. Europe, 6, 7, 8%, depending on what country you're in. 3%. And we have no measures of the devices that I'm telling you about. I spent a lot of my own money. For one chapter alone in my book, I spent $2,500 on photocopying so we could prove one of the devices. We had to find a single sentence, and there was no practical way to do it except photocopy $2,500 worth of papers and then go through and find it. And all of the stuff in my book comes from either official government documents, the people that I'm writing about, lawsuits, which I guess are official government documents, corporate records. And I give you chapter and verse, location, place, you know, where these things came from. And if anybody finds something they want to know more about, tell me, and we'll put the document up on my website, freelunchthebook.com. We've done one. There's supposed to be a second one up there. Two so far readers have asked about. By the way, tomorrow the New York Times is running my letter to the editor about the review and his response, and a letter from somebody else about the review. There's one other industry I want to talk about. Again, and it's electricity, because it is the core of modern life is electricity. A couple of years ago, my wife and I and my two youngest children went to Pompeii. And you walk around Pompeii and Herculaneum, or you walk around the cities that still exist in southern France, and the most striking feature is that these people were exactly like us. They had bars and restaurants and hair salons and the layout of how the bars were was amazingly like a lot of bars in America today. Now, this being ancient Rome, they're a little different in that they had all these whorehouses. But that's just a cultural difference. But there are two things you're struck by. They didn't have internal combustion engines. So the scale of everything is the scale of a modern suburban mall. If anything, it's a little narrower than a suburban mall because people could walk everywhere. The advantage is, of course, you can walk all the way across town in a couple of minutes. It's not like if you wanted to walk all the way across even Rochester. The other thing is they didn't have electricity. Other than that, they're no different than us. People are people. We haven't really evolved in the biological sense in the last 5,000 years. Well, what's happened to electricity? In the 1970s, big industrial customers, manufacturing plants, automakers, people like that, complained that the system of regulating electricity prices was unfair to them. They didn't argue that the prices were unfair. What they argued was that they were being charged more than they should because they were big volume users, and that you as homeowners and small business owners were not paying enough. In effect, they said, we're subsidizing you. They didn't get very far with this argument until they ran into a guy named Ken Lay. Ken Lay sent teams of people out all over the country to lobby for new laws, and their argument was this. The distribution of electricity is a natural monopoly. I mean, anybody want to have 18 sets of wires running down their street? There are actually about six cities in America that have two sets of wires running down their street, and they look a lot awful. But they said generation of electricity. That's not a natural monopoly. So let's create a market. Let's go to Adam Smith's idea here, that markets will produce the greatest benefit, that the invisible hand of the market, as each producer tries to be as efficient and effective as they can at selling their product, will result in the lowest possible price to the consumer. So we're going to create electricity markets, and then they can sell to the utilities. Well, 26 of the states went for this. And I retell how this bill was passed in Texas as the story of the Siege of Troy. It's got all the characters. I mean, it's got Laocoon, it's got Cassandra, it's even got Odysseus. And these laws were passed, and what happened is that in Texas, electricity prices doubled. They didn't go down, they doubled. In fact, I show in the book that at times, electricity that utilities were, that generators were willing to give away, because if you have a nuclear power plant, it's got to run 24 hours a day at a steady state. If you have a really big coal plant, you basically have to run it 24 hours a day at a steady state. So they would offer to give power away at low demand times, say March, 2 o'clock in the morning, or maybe $1 for a megawatt. And the typical price for electricity should be $35, $60 a megawatt, depending on where you live in the country and the mix of fuels. But the way these markets were designed by Enron caused people to pay as much as $990. And here's how that worked. Let's say that you wanted to buy the land I mentioned, George Bush, at the where you wanted to build a ballpark. You go around and buy up pieces of land and have people do it on your behalf, and you'll get some land at $1,000 an acre and some at $10, and maybe the last little bit you'll pay $50,000 an acre, but it'll just be a little bit of land. And your average price will be $3,000 an acre. In these markets, whatever is the highest price needed to get the last unit of electricity goes to everybody. So Enron's law allowed the following. It allowed the utilities to take their power plants, remove them from the regulated monopoly company, put them over here in the competitive market. So notice, same power plant, same location, same power, same customers, different pocket. Moved it from this pocket to that pocket. Now they're selling electricity back into the market. Now, if you only own one power plant, if you're a little merchant investor, you know, all of us got together and decided, okay, we'll each put up $100, we're going to invest in a power plant. We wanted the thing to run all the time because we got to pay for it. But what if you own 40 or 80 or 100 power plants? You can take some of them offline. They need to be repaired. Or you make a bid that's so high, nobody buys your power. And lo and behold, you end up paying $990 for power that if it was at the average price, would have cost $30. This is not a market. You can call it a market. Remember what Abraham Lincoln said about a cow's tail? Supposedly, you call a cow's tail a fifth leg, doesn't make it a fifth leg. These are not markets. These are devices to drive up prices to consumers and enrich the people who own these plants. Now, curiously, a lot of these people who got into this area of power have gone broke. Why would that happen if you get this huge subsidy from a rigged market? Well, Adam Smith told us about that. He said you would expect that people get a big subsidy from the government would have huge profits, but they don't. They often go broke because instead of chasing the business, they chase the subsidy. And because once it's not your money at risk, rash adventurers who don't know how to husband their resources are drawn into the market because there's no risk to them. So what's happened to the pricing of electricity in this country is it's gone through the roof. Well, it's costing jobs. During the California energy crisis, legislators in California, Oregon, and Washington were being besieged by phone calls. Business owners, school districts, individuals. And so a few weeks after the Bush administration came into office, Vice President Cheney met in the sub-basement of the U.S. Senate with the Northwest delegation. He had one rule for coming to the meeting. No Californians allowed in the room. They all sit down, and both Democrats and Republicans start telling the vice president these horror stories. And as they're doing this, the door suddenly opens, and a congressman named Jay Inslee, former prosecutor and inveterate basketball player, slides into the room, sees one empty chair, and being a great basketball player, he just slides into that chair and sits down, and lo and behold, he's face-to-face with Dick Cheney, whom he's never met. And as they go around the room telling their stories, Republicans and Democrats alike, One of the speakers says, look, I've got thousands of people who've been thrown out of work because of the electricity prices. Grocery stores that say they can't keep frozen food because they can't afford to run the refrigerators. Somebody points out old ladies who've had their power shut off. And then somebody points out, hey, look, we've got poor families that have had their power shut off and they're using candles. And you know it's just a matter of time until there's an awful fire and a bunch of children die. And all through this, Congressman Inslee watches and Cheney doesn't care. It's eminently clear to him that he doesn't care. And he understands, because who he thinks Cheney is, that he doesn't care about the little old ladies. But when they start talking about the business owners, now he's completely confused. Because in his mind, Mr. Cheney is a business guy. How can he be indifferent to the concerns of these business owners? Well, finally, Inslee is one of the most junior members of the delegation. His turn comes, and he was late because he was waiting for a fax. And he says, I have this fax here. I want to show you. And he slides it across the table and he says, Mr. Vice President, this fact shows that even though record high prices were available for power in California yesterday, one-third of the power plants were shut down. Now, of course, when you can get record high prices, who stops selling? That makes no sense. And Cheney, without looking at the piece of paper, and I interviewed a whole bunch of the congressmen who were in the room about this in both parties, slides it back to Inslee and says, you know what your problem is, Congressman? You don't know anything about economics. Anybody want to guess what Mr. Inslee's college degree is in? How many of you own a home? Do you remember the first time you bought a house? Maybe it's the only one you ever bought. How wonderful that felt? I can easily recall. I was 22 years old. My parents never owned a home. My dad was a 100% disabled veteran. My own money, I went and bought a house. Just sold last year because it was in Silicon Valley for $1 million. Just a little stucco, two-bedroom, three-bath starter house. But I was so proud. I had 20% down. I went and I got a loan. And when you have all these pieces of paper stuck in front of you, sign this, initial that, sign this, you know, then they say an hour later, okay, it's yours. You go home and you look at that paperwork and you'll suddenly notice that there's one really big item on it. It's typically half the price you paid for the house. So it's a $200,000 house. It'll be about $1,000. It's called land title insurance. What the hell is land title insurance? Well, it's to guarantee that if somebody comes along and has put a lien on the property you didn't know about, or claims they have an interest in it, or the right to drill an oil well in your backyard, that you're protected, or should we say if it's a 20% down, the bank is protected. And it adds about 0.5%. By the way, the value of residential housing in the United States, owner-occupied, including second homes, is around $20 trillion before the current meltdown. So 0.5% is a lot of money. Well, turns out that 90 cents on the dollar of what you pay, $900 of that $1,000, does not go to buy title insurance. It goes to pay bribes and kickbacks, or what are politely called referral fees. This is what economists call a reverse market. In a normal market, the pressure is to push prices down. In a reverse market, the pressure is to push prices up. And the reason for that is you're not the customer. You're just the schlub who writes the check. In the land title system, if you go to the phone book and open it up, in most cities you'll see page after page of land title companies. And you would think this is an incredibly vibrant market. Look how many competitors there are. Well, in fact, five companies have 90% of the business. They just operate through lots of little different names. Those companies collect about $16 billion a year, four times what they were collecting in 1980. And how much do they pay out in claims? Less than a nickel per dollar of what you pay. One of these land title companies, in its report to shareholders and the government, said, our customers are lawyers, are real estate lawyers, mortgage brokers, appraisers, and real estate agents. Notice who's missing. You. You know, most of the world doesn't have land title insurance. They don't have it in Puerto Rico. They don't have it in Europe. They don't have it in Australia or New Zealand, and they do just fine. And the land title insurance companies now have a new idea they want to sell you. They want you, when you buy a used car, to buy used car title insurance. And guess what? Most of the money you pay won't go to you. It'll go to the car dealer or the salesman. Now, these payments that it claws the price of this product, even if done at retail, to be 10 times what it should be, are illegal. They're criminal violations of the law. They're illegal. The state of Washington and the state of California did investigations of this, found that 88 to 92 cents on the dollar went to these kickbacks. And then what did the regulators say was the solution? We need to better educate the industry about its duties under the law. Well, okay, that was about 3 years ago. So if that education system worked, what would happen? Land title insurance prices would fall. They've gone up. What we need are some prosecutions of people for violating these laws. There are a lot of other examples that are in my book of ways in which we have developed, under the guise of deregulation, markets are the solution, government is the problem, policies that I don't think Ronald Reagan had the intention of doing, partly because he didn't think about it. He was not a detail guy. Ronald Reagan, whether you love the man or hate the man, he was a great leader. He changed this country in very dramatic and fundamental ways. Leaders are people who get others to go along with what they want. And the period from up to 1980, after the war, and the period since then are very clear divides. When wages were their highest in this country, about more than one-third of private industry workers belonged to unions. You know, I was in the Netherlands for 5 days in November, speaking at the annual conference of Dutch and Flemish investigative reporters. And I sat many of them down one-on-one or two-on-one to talk to them, and I would ask them all about their finances. They either owned their homes outright, or they rented, or they lived with their parents. They owned their cars outright, or they rode public transit. The trains were so efficient that people would give me directions to get from Amsterdam up to this little town in the far north that we were meeting in. And they would say, the train will arrive at 12:02, go down the ramp, turn left, go four ramps, go up, there'll be a train at 12:04. Problem was, I came down the wrong ramp and went the wrong direction, so I had to wait 12 minutes for another train. But they run on time, and they were unbelievably cheap. All of these people had savings, lots of savings. I finally, one woman about 30 years old, she said to me, well, yeah, I do have a loan, but don't tell anybody. This was shameful. And I said, well, what happened? She said, well, I got in a car accident. I wanted to get a new car. You know, we're going to get married. We're going to have kids, so I want to get a little bigger car. So I borrowed $2,500. And I said, well, why don't you take it out of your savings? And she said, well, because I don't want to stop saving for the wedding. I said, oh, you're saving so you can have a big wedding? She looks at me like I'm an idiot. And I go, well, you're not saving for a big honeymoon either, I can tell. And she said, no, we're saving for a house. I said, oh, so as soon as you get a down payment, you're... She said, no, we're saving to buy a house. As soon as we buy the house, we'll get married and start having children. Think about that. Think about all the Americans who are in debt. In this country, for every dollar of equity, this is federal government data, for every dollar of equity in real terms that people have added to their homes since 1980, they have taken on $2 of debt and the interest payments on that debt. That is not a prescription for prosperity. That is a prescription for being in a hamster wheel forever. This is nuts. This is absolutely nuts. We have a healthcare system that is driving jobs offshore. Where's the biggest center of auto manufacturing in North America? Canada. Ontario. Why? They still have the cost of healthcare, but it doesn't appear on the books of the company, so it isn't built into the price of the car. It's not on their books. And I have a daughter who's emigrating to Toronto and going to law school, going to practice law there. So we've been going there a lot. I haven't found anybody yet who's unhappy about their health care. You know, there are these stories that appear about it. Now, if we go to a different health care system, and I'm not advocating any particular health care system, it will have problems just like the one we do now. Okay? All solutions create new problems. But our problems are 47 million people without insurance, children who grow up who never learn because they're not properly diagnosed for eyeglasses. I have a young man that I grew up with who spent most of his life in prison, who I believe if he'd had proper medical care as a kid, wouldn't have spent most of his life in prison. He ended up becoming a violent, nasty criminal. He belongs in prison. But I think it was because of health care. Jennifer and I have friends who died because they got cancer. Breast cancer or other kinds of cancer, and they didn't have health insurance. And by the time they got government care, they were going to die. you can go into poor areas of this country, as I have, and meet people who have horrible disfiguring problems, you know, funny bone structures and things. And if you can get them to talk, you find out, well, yeah, you know, I got hurt in the factory, and the company said it was they weren't going to pay for it. Never mind, there's a workers' compensation law. I did a story in the New York Times 10 years ago about a man in, here in upstate New York who was working on an electric power pole, got shot with a jolt of electricity, head first into the pavement, snapped his neck, and he was in court fighting to get his benefits. He'd fallen 35 years earlier, and he hadn't gotten his benefits. I will say he did get them, or at least part of them, after Governor Pataki personally intervened. But that's what it took. So think about somebody who doesn't get me putting their story in the front page of the New York Times. And there are people here in Rochester who I've talked to who have never been able to collect on their workers' comp, even though they're supposed to. It's supposed to be a no-fault system. It seems to me that we created this country so that we could be free. We created this country so that we could determine our own destiny. We didn't need King George to tell us what to do. Because whatever problems we have, we can solve them. And, you know, for all of our faults and all of our problems, we've done a tremendous job. I mean, we got rid of slavery. Somehow women persuaded men to give them the right to vote. We've got child labor laws. We have universal education. We've done lots of things to be a healthier society. But what we have going on now is something people don't know about. That's why I wrote Free Lunch. That's my role in society. I do investigative reporting. I tell you, when I find something that is as it appears to be, I'm totally bored. But whenever I find something that isn't like it's supposed to be, that's when I go, wait a minute, what's going on here? And we have a society in which we are taking from the many to give to the few, in which we are subsidizing the Waltons, the wealthiest family in America. Even if you don't do business with them, you're subsidizing them. We are taking money out of people's pockets to subsidize Tyco and George Steinbrenner and Donald Trump. We are taking money out of people's pockets to subsidize people who own electric power plants. If you're rich enough to own an electric power plant, I don't think you need a subsidy. And the constant mantra is jobs. What we need are jobs. Well, we have 11 times as many people in prison today as we did in 1970. So the unemployment rate would be a lot higher if we didn't have that policy. We are moving jobs offshore. And if you're the CEO of a big company, frankly, if you're not firing workers as fast as you can, moving your assets offshore, moving your intellectual property offshore, you should be fired. You should lose your job. And the reason is Congress has set up rules to do that. And I even tell about how the Chinese communists enacted an income tax law at the request of American companies. Why? Because it would allow these companies to shortchange the American government. And they told the Chinese that. And if you're a Marxist who's been raised and indoctrinated so that you're a high-level party official in Beijing, can you imagine a better proof of Lenin's dictum that the capitalists will sell you the rope with which we will hang them? We have a government that is completely out of touch with the people. We have a government of moneyed people. We have something called, I call the political donor class. We can solve this problem. Now, I offer a solution in the book, and I'll tell you about that in just a second, and then I'll take your questions. When you read Free Lunch, you may not like my solution. A couple of reviewers have said it's naive. Okay, fine. Maybe I'm naive, and I'm not in that business. I'm in the diagnosing business, not the problem-solving business. That's a much harder business to be in. Ask Susan B. Anthony. Right? Okay. Ask Frederick Douglass how hard it was to be in the problem-solving business. Economic theory tells us that the Congress we have and the state legislatures we have are exactly what we should expect. They come from safe districts. If you're a D or you're an R, your district has been gerrymandered to make it almost all D's and almost all R's. This is an unusual year where we have lots of people dropping out. But historically, these have been very safe. We've had typically about 8 competitive congressional districts per election in the last 40 years. This year we'll have a lot more, but typically about 8. So then your real constituency becomes the people who provide you with the money to stay in office. Those are the people whom you depend on, your campaign donors. And what happens in Washington? Well, companies. There are 35,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C. for 535 members of Congress and the Senate. That's twice as many lobbyists as there were in 2000. Why? It is a universal truth that it is easier to mine gold from the government treasury than from the side of a mountain or to earn it in the marketplace. And these folks are milking the government for everything they can get. They employ huge squads of PR people. Some of the stories that I have worked on, they have flown a dozen people into New York to talk to my editors, to tell my editors, you got to do something about this guy. You know, my editors are, great thing about the LA Times, you know, I mean the New York Times, there's no reverence for the writer's word, but by God, they got backbone. And I talked to a reporter at a little paper in Galveston, Texas, who's counted that there are basically 11 PR people every time he writes a story who are assigned to go around and try to stop his work or interfere with his work or sow bad relations with his editors by just complaining all the time. So the editors are going, oh, he's going to write another one of those stories. How about you go cover the baseball game today? My proposed solution is this. Companies now give rides in corporate jets to go give speeches and things under the rules Congress has. We had the famous $250,000 golf outing for Tom DeLay and others. How do you spend $250,000 on a golf outing? You mean solid gold golf balls? And every time you hit one, you get another? Free meals. You'll read a whole thing about a restaurant and how really sleazy the operation of this restaurant was that was used to influence legislation. So my suggestion, and the Supreme Court has held in a case called Buckley, that dollars are free speech. That if you want to start regulating donations, you're now interfering with free speech. Now, I think that's a radical idea, but that's the law of the land. So then the question becomes, what do you do about it? My solution is something I call politician finance reform with zero tolerance. And my suggestion is this. We as taxpayers try to get a free lunch when we don't pay the real costs of Congress. The use of the corporate jets, the dinners, all the other stuff, the jobs for wives and relatives, the rules that allow you, if you're running for office, to have your spouse paid a percentage of the campaign donations. If that doesn't smell like a bribe, then nothing is a bribe. We're going to ban all that. We will pay every cost. Anything you do, we'll pay the cost. We're going to pay for somebody to be at your side every moment, collect the receipts, write them down. We don't care if it's 25 cents. We're going to collect it. We're going to put it all up on the internet. There are plenty of organizations in Washington that will analyze this stuff and tell you about it. And, of course, the congressman from Hawaii is going to spend one heck of a lot more on transportation than the one who lives in Northern Virginia. Voters aren't stupid. They'll figure it out. It's when the guy in Montana spends 10 times what the guy in Hawaii spends that there'll be attention paid to it. And we're going to be just like the franking privilege. Members of Congress can send all the official mail they want. No limit. Senator, if you're on the Health Committee and it is vital to your duties to go down to Tahiti and inspect the cleanliness of the sink behind the bar on the beach, by golly, we're going to pay for it. But we're going to tell everybody what you did. And in return for this, if you take a cup of coffee, you go to jail. You don't take anything. Nothing, period, will completely insulate you from this legalized system of bribery. Now, maybe that's not the right solution, but maybe it will get us talking about, well, how do we do this? How do we get a Congress that represents the people, not the moneyed people and the big corporations? Because if we don't do that, if we don't recognize that our government is out of touch with us, that our government is turning into a vehicle not to ensure our liberties, but to make the already rich richer by taking from those with less to give to those with more, I can tell you what will happen. It may not happen in my lifetime. It may not happen for a long time. But sooner or later, it will result in teenagers sitting down in school and picking up textbooks with a chapter that begins with these words. The United States of America was. So thank you.
You're listening to a talk by investigative journalist and author David K. Johnston on his book, Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. The talk was given February 16th in Rochester, New York. We'll return with questions from the audience. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. And now the conclusion of the talk by David K. Johnston as he answers questions from the audience.
So who has questions? Ma'am.
I really feel that you have satisfied your obligation as a citizen by making us aware and doing the documentation, and I know I'm outraged.
Opinions vary on that, but go ahead.
I know I'm outraged, but my thoughts about what the problem also is that myself and probably most of us are going to leave this place outraged as we are and do nothing. And
I would expect that no matter what.
But that is part of the problem.
Yes.
The problem is, what is our responsibility? What was our responsibility when we went into Iraq? My husband said, war tax, draft.
Right.
If you did that, maybe we would have thought twice about it. If we go to all the war, many of us will get checks from the government in the next few months. No one's saying, where's this money coming from? There's already a major debt.
Right.
We do not take responsibility. We don't vote.
I agree with you about that. Here's what's happened in this country. I think prosperity has not been good for democracy.
I agree with
poverty
you.
In America is not like poverty in the third world. When I was a younger man, and I never went overseas till I was 30 years old, because I had all these kids, five of them by the time I was 23. First time I went overseas, I remember telling the cab driver I wanted to go to the poorest part of Cairo. Now, I don't believe he took me to the poorest part of Cairo, but it was god-awful. And it wasn't anything like here. I think a lot of people are going, hey, you know, things are better. They're okay. I'm getting along. And they don't pay attention. And they don't, as people did in as recently as the 50s, read two or three newspapers and sit around the barbershop and talk about, or the hair salon, issues that affect our society. And that's a real problem. Just as outsourcing jobs has not done very well for the economy, outsourcing democracy to campaign donors and large corporations has been a first-rate disaster. That part I can't deal with. But, you know, there are people who organize, who get things going. And what I'm doing is saying, here's a lens. Because if you read Free Lunch, everything you read in the news, I promise you, will look different. You will read things in the DNC and go, wait a minute, that you would have never noticed before. Because it'll give you a lens. And then you can start talking about it. And here's one thing about politicians. All politicians, because it's the nature of what they do, just like there are certain things reporters do. They do this. And as soon as they detect that wind has shifted, behavior will shift. So, back there.
First a comment, Dave, but on your opening remarks, I don't know if you saw it within the last month, Business Week gave you a very favorable review.
Yes.
Can't hear you.
Business Week gave me a very favorable review.
My question is, you mentioned the Netherlands, and most of the corporations we're talking about in the upper 1%, are multinational. Have you seen any kind of success by them and other first world democracies the way they've rated our treasury and our taxes here? Or is this mostly a phenomenon in the United States?
No, this is the question is this phenomenon I've been describing to you all day uniquely American, or is it going all over the world? There are problems with large corporations and taxes all over the world. And there's a fundamental question we should be asking about, why do we allow money to go into these tax havens? You know, there's more money on deposit in theory and paper in the Cayman Islands than in New York City. And, of course, anything that can be used by a big company to avoid taxes can be used by drug dealers and terrorists to move money around in secret, too. Why haven't we shut all this stuff off? Okay, but the magnitude of the problems are nowhere in other countries like that. And one of the things I asked people in the Netherlands was about, they were just laughing about Americans and credit cards and talking about ads some of them had seen on a TV show there that have run in the United States, and just thought we were absolute idiots that were ruining our country to their gain. So I think a lot of it's culture. We have to change our culture. So over here, and you're next.
Paul, have you put your lens on the green energy?
No, I haven't. No.
New York State and the windmill.
No, I have not.
The new eminent domain in our world.
No, no. What I did in this book is talk about those things that people don't know about, and in a size and a format people get to. Like, there's nothing about agricultural subsidies in my book. There are a couple of other big subsidies. There's nothing in there about them. Because what I was trying to do was get people to see things that are in their lives all around them that they're not aware of. And that was one I didn't do. Now, there's another book I'm working on where I will undoubtedly go into that. So,
you mentioned the competitive...
Louder.
Sorry. You mentioned the competitive advantage that manufacturers have in countries where healthcare is publicly funded. Why aren't U.S. manufacturers supporting socialized medicine?
Why aren't U.S. manufacturers supporting socialized medicine is the question. Because there's a competitive advantage in the marketplace. Well, actually, for a long time, the big auto companies did. The big auto companies, which basically are the market, did. And the thing that opened my eyes to this was a businessman here in town, a very wealthy, very successful businessman who I had dinner with one night about 12 years ago, who was complaining to me that he competes against big multinationals in a couple of his many businesses. And he said, they buy the market. They pay for health care, whatever we would pay if we had the government buying health care. But I'm a relatively small businessman. He has, I don't know, 3,000-4,000 employees, not hundreds of thousands. And he said, I have to pay somebody to negotiate these contracts and spend all this time on it. And in my little hotel management company with my son, it's like, what am I doing spending 2 minutes of my time with health care? I want to manage hotels. I don't want to do this. Why is the business community not doing this? The national leaders of their movement have this ideological perspective. Anything other than the business model of healthcare is socialism. You know, and their review is not practical. My view is, how do you get the most bang for the buck? You and then you. There's in the leather jacket.
I've worked for state legislators for a long time, so I know something about both state legislators and federal. There's only one way, one effective way to reach and pressure a legislator on any level. That is to meet with the legislator, to bring up the issue, and to contribute, however symbolically, to their campaign.
Right.
And then to follow up after you have met to see whether the legislator has moved on the issue.
Well, I agree with you, and that's part of the problem. The argument is the only way you're going to get legislatures of any level to act is meeting with them in person and campaign contributions. For the last 13 years in speeches all across the country, I've said to people, try this little experiment. Call your congressperson. Call their office and ask for a meeting and say, look, I'm a constituent. Here's my name. Here's my phone number. Anytime I will come down and meet, I want 15 minutes or 5 minutes or 10, depending on which audience I was with, my congressperson. Nobody has ever called me back and told me they got a meeting. Two people have called me back and said they were asked, are you a donor? Now, that question is a federal felony, okay? I've had people tell me that when they said what they wanted to talk about, they were lectured by their congressman on what real Americans should think and how they should be ashamed of their views and what was wrong with them. I've had people give other answers like that. But so far, nobody's called me and said, hey, you know, I called, and they said, sure, how about 5 minutes next Thursday at 11 a.m.? Oh, wait, I said you were next in the leather jacket.
Oh, just a comment.
I'll do all three.
You said you were going to talk about Mellon.
Oh, Mellon, thank you, Andrew Mellon. Any of you who are familiar with 1920s history know that Andrew Mellon ranks second only probably to Sam Insull, who was the Ken Lay of his day in the electricity business, as sort of a public villain among progressives and unionists. He was the Treasury Secretary. He was an oil man from Pittsburgh. Well, here's what... who's got my book? You do. Andrew Mellon's name has been invoked in Congress to support a number of the tax cuts on capital that we have, and we now tax capital far, far below... far, far below the level at which we tax wages. And here's what Andrew Mellon said, calling for a tax increase. The fairness of taxing more lightly income from wages, salaries, or from investments is beyond question. In the first case, that's wages and salaries, the income is uncertain, of limited duration. Sickness or death destroys it. Old age diminishes it. To the other, that's capital, the source of income continues.
The income may be disposed of during a man's lifetime, and it descends to his heirs. Surely we can afford to make a distinction between the people whose only capital is their mental and physical energy and the people whose income is derived from investments. Such a distinction would mean much to millions of American workers and would be an added inspiration to the man who must provide a competence during his few productive years to care for himself and his family when his earnings capacity is at end. I'm sorry, he said that today on the floor of Congress. I guarantee you Fox News and the Wall Street Journal editorial page would call you a commie. Andrew Mellon. Oh, I said I was going to do all three of you, so you and then you.
Okay.
Go. No, you.
Quick question.
Quick ones are best.
What's that?
Quick ones are best.
Oh, yes. I was wondering, you didn't talk about trade policy as much. And I actually worked on one of the races in the area.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we're pushing is fair trade rather than free trade to try to break the cycle of China by holding companies that we trade with to the same standard that we have for our workers.
So what's the question?
The question is, what do you think about fair trade?
Okay. Chapter 4 of my book is called Chinese Magnetism. First of all, there's no such thing as free trade. There's no such thing as deregulation. There's no such thing as free markets. Everything has rules. We have rules that subsidize trade with and encourage companies to move jobs offshore and capital offshore, and I give you the economics of this in the book. More importantly, I tell you how this policy has gone so awry that we have endangered our national security. Okay? It should really trouble you what's in Chapter 4 if you think about it. And I will tell you that hopefully this will not happen, but the Chinese military leadership, and you can read this stuff in military journals and on the Internet and elsewhere, the Chinese military leadership is indoctrinating its young officer corps, just as we indoctrinate our young officer corps, with the idea that war with the United States is inevitable. Now, you know, God forbid that happens. But when you read my chapter, knowing that fact, I promise you it will give you real serious chills about what we're doing here. Trade policies, Adam Smith would not support trade policies that destroy your own home base. Let's see, you.
Yes.
Now we're going to go this way.
Thank you for speaking today. My question is simple, and I'm sure you agree. There's a lot more in your book than you were able to tell us today. Therefore, I will leave here... And I'd like to share this with everyone. I'm going to the bookstore and buy your book unless you have it here.
Oh, we do. We got it in the background.
Because I want to read it completely. Secondly, I will encourage my coworkers and my family to read it or read parts of it, even if I have to tell them about what's in there. And thirdly, I will encourage everyone, even if people don't want to read the book, to share these things, the things that you brought up, the issues that you brought up, with coworkers, with family. There are too many people who are in the dark. They don't read. They don't pay attention.
Thank you. And I guess that answers the question of the woman who was sitting here in the very beginning. Okay. Stop. Okay.
You talked about the transfer of wealth from... You talked about the transfer of wealth from us to the wealthiest Americans, the wealthiest corporations. Could you comment on the transfer of wealth from the income tax to... the Federal Reserve Bank and the selling out of our sovereignty, basically, to people buying bonds like the communist Chinese?
Well, Chapter 4 of my book talks about exactly this issue. Basically, to finance our consumption, we have been selling bonds. The Chinese, who can't invest as fast as they want to, have been buying so that we keep sustaining our economy, our bonds, which means they now have a huge lever over the American economy. And the risks that we are facing of some serious economic drop are very significant when you add in the subprime mess where you have this securitization of assets where it used to be if you had a problem with your mortgage, you'd go to the bank and say, let's work it out, and maybe the bank would take a haircut or you would have more onerous terms. Instead, you can't do that because these mortgages have been sliced and diced into pieces and a tenth of it sold here and 21% sold over here. Nobody knows where they are. And all of these are the result of the policies of our government that have said, we're just going to trust the market. There we've had pretty much a free market. We've really pulled back the rules on these things and allowed Wall Street to invent all sorts of products that have turned out to be disasters, except for the people who collected the fees up front.
I was very happy to hear you say that a solution to this problem is public financing of elections.
No, I didn't say that.
Well, sort of.
No.
Taking the money out of politics.
Yes.
Right? Okay. And I'd just like to say that...
Well, no. Let me back up. I want to take out, I don't want to, I want, what I want to do is take out the free gifts and things. That's not campaign contributions.
Okay. Well, I relate it. There's something concrete that each one of us here today can do to help that problem, and that's to take part in an ad, a full-page ad, that Clean Money, Clean Elections, a task force of Metro Justice, is going to put in the DNC later this month in February. Just go to the metrojustice.org site, click on the activities, look for the Clean Money, Clean Elections ad. It's a very compelling ad. It's going to specify the problem, the solutions, and it's looking for 150 people to have your name added to this ad to show support. It's a $25 charge to have your name added because of the cost of the ad. So metrojustice.org.
Good ad for the ad. Remember, every problem creates a solution, and one thing you should think about if you think about publicly financed campaigns is whether that grants an advantage to incumbents.
Real quick, thank you for coming. If you focused your lens on local tools that seem to enable these things at a national level, things along the lines of LDAs, CAMEA, all of those things.
Right.
Do you have any comments on that? I know you're a resident from Brighton. We've had our share of things.
Well, I have not. Listen, I haven't paid much attention beyond reading the paper to the things that have gone on here. I was, of all the deals I read about in town, the one I was most struck by and didn't go through was Clear Channel, the big national radio company from Texas. Their license is in Rochester, New York. They wanted to move out to Henrietta or somewhere out in the suburbs. They had to be within a certain mileage of the city of Rochester. And they were asking for a subsidy to move across town. Excuse me? Hey, you know what? I want to buy my neighbor's house two blocks over. You think the county will give me money to pay for the movers? I mean, that was just the audacity of even asking for that indicates how totally out of hand this has gotten. Somebody, you were. You, sir.
I really like your solution, as the other woman said, of keeping track of the spending that politicians do on getting reelected. But I totally distrust legislation that would enact that could get through Congress.
Oh, it would take an enormous amount of public pressure to get that enacted.
Yeah. I was wondering if there was something that private citizens could do to get these activities, these transactions, onto YouTube.
Is there something private citizens can do to get these activities and transactions onto YouTube? Sure. And you can, you know, there's a lot of stuff reported in Washington, and there are groups in Washington that gather this stuff, and you can make use of them. But here's another idea. So have some barbecues this summer and have people come over and talk about these issues. Don't talk about the baseball game or the weather. Talk about these issues. How do we get a democracy of the kind we want?
But I heard you on Bob Smith's Hour on XXI. You talked about not only subsidizing the Waltons, but with the creation of empire and enterprise zones.
Right.
And I think I understood that not just other big box stores such as Target and Home Depot are also set up for the kind of mechanism that our tax dollars don't make it to the libraries and the parks.
Right.
Could you just give a couple of summary sentences on how that's not just the Waltons, but a lot of the stores
there are also,
and the malls?
There are entire shopping malls in this country that are financed this way. Right now there's a lawsuit going on in Arizona. There's a high-end luxury shopping mall going to be brought. And a lawyer named Clint Bullock, who's been identified with the groups on the very right, is with the Goldwater Institute, Barry Goldwater legacy, is suing, saying they're going to get $94 million of sales tax money. They didn't even ask for it when they came. It is unfair to other merchants. It is, why are we being taxed for this private benefit? The city of Phoenix and the court so far have taken the same position that was taken in a case I tell about in the book involving Toledo, Ohio. You have no grounds to complain. We will not listen to your complaint. You have no right to file a lawsuit. And that's been generally the attitude of the courts. Go ahead.
Have you any written about campaign finance?
No. I wrote about campaign finance in the 70s.
What?
I wrote about campaign finance in the 70s. But there are lots of reporters who cover that now, and I have not spent my time covering it. I spend my time covering things nobody else writes about. Let's start far in.
I wanted to ask you real quickly about the new national budget that came out. They're no longer printing it anymore.
Yeah.
They're putting it on computer. I want to hear some of your thoughts as to why that is and what's going to be hidden.
Oh, I don't think anybody hidden. It's much. I mean, I'm a guy who buys the national budget, and it's much easier. The administration announced they're no longer going to give except a handful of members of Congress a copy of the printed 5-volume version of the budget.
but you can get it free online. Well, actually, that's an improvement because you can search. So I actually think that may be a good thing. You know, and I'm a newspaper guy.
Healthcare for our elected officials.
Yeah.
Expand on that a little bit.
Healthcare for our elected officials.
Do they have free healthcare?
Oh, yeah.
That's in their life, basically.
Members of Congress do. President and Vice President do. I don't know about others. Okay, but, you know, government officials have, quote-unquote, socialized health care, and the rest of us don't.
Well, I mean, one thing, David, we're about to go into a recession, and Congress has said they're going to give a subsidy to avoid recession. Almost all of it's going to go to the middle and lower classes. Why in 2001, when we were on the dawn of the last recession, did we give a $2 trillion tax cut almost exclusively to less than 1% of America?
Right. Because the question is, why in the just before we started the last brief recession in 2001, did we give this huge tax cut that went to the top when this new one is to flood money down at the bottom? Well, first of all of this money is borrowed. You never got a tax cut. Every dollar of tax cut was simply charged to the government's credit card, and you're going to pay 5% interest on it or 4% interest forever. We're just borrowing it from ourselves or from overseas. That's right. The reason they were able to skew it to the top was that throughout the campaign, George Bush would not tell what his plan was. He had a chart that stopped at $100,000 of income. And it didn't matter how many times I called or other people called and asked about it, they wouldn't talk. And the voters clearly didn't care. Now, 1 week after President Bush took office, and this is in my previous book, Perfectly Legal, which you can get in paperback, President Bush's bill was introduced. I printed it out right away, sat down, read it, literally jumped out of my chair, ran to an editor, and said, there is an enormous, I don't know how big, but enormous, hidden tax cut in here for the super wealthy. It's got to be worth tens of billions of dollars, and I wouldn't be shocked if it's worth hundreds of billions of dollars. It's even conceivable in over 10 years it might be a trillion. And we ran a story about it on the front page. I had to quote a lawyer because, as the rules of journalism are, I can't quote myself. About this. The White House was very careful the next day when reporters asked about it, and they asked about my work by name. And the White House press spokesman did not quarrel with my story. He said, well, we certainly didn't mean to do that. And if that were there, we will address that. Subsequently, a very smart Capitol Hill guy sent two letters from two different congressmen to the Joint Committee on Taxation asking two really brilliant questions, very technical. I'm not going to worry you with the questions. But when he got back the answers, all he had to do was lay the two pieces of paper down side by side, and you could see that there was a stealth $250 billion tax cut only for the super rich. And then it disappeared from the bill. The only tax policy change George Bush ever made. The reason for that? That's who elected him. What did President Bush say at the Waldorf Astoria at the dinner? You're my base. Some people call you the haves and the have-mores. I call you my base. Far back, and then you.
Yeah, you talked a bit about politicians as well as corporations, but I wonder what role the media has played in this, as well as higher education academics who are involved in the debate. Let me give you a concrete example. You have the New York Times, the Washington Post, that have more or less supported the outsourcing of jobs.
In the editorial page.
You made his statements at the time. The editorial board came out very strongly favor of Matthew's statement, as well as the Washington Post. So what role is the media here, as well as education?
What's the role of the news media here in these policies, okay? The first thing I want to do is quarrel with your question. Don't usually do that. But it is really important to understand something. The news pages of a newspaper and the editorial pages of the paper have nothing to do with each other. When I was at the LA Times, they literally once ran an editorial saying, in effect, don't believe what you're reading in the news pages written by this guy. I am not unique about that. I know other reporters this has happened to. There's no influence between these things. I mean, I read things in my in every newspaper I've worked for. I picked up the editorial page and gone, that's loony. But they're not affecting the newsroom. The role, I think, of the news media in this has been a significant decline in skepticism, the cowing of people by all of these attack groups that take apart your work. You know, there's an anonymous poster out on the internet has the David K. Johnston blog. You know, if you go look at it, read it critically, because the guy, everything he accuses me of, my own statement show is untrue. But I get people all the time who they don't read critically.
And they claim that I've said things I've never said because they just take the accusation as being true. The news media does not have enough people who are good at economics and economic policy covering these issues. And as the rise of goods mongering has occurred, did Britney get drunk last night? We've seen a decline in interest in serious news. And the New York Times newsroom, we're going to have 100 layoffs. Okay, buyouts, hopefully. Not layoffs, buyouts. It's a real fundamental problem. Sir?
Two quick questions. Number one, Billet and Johnson, I understand, have come out with a book, Where the Money Goes, a guide through the federal budget.
Oh, there's a lot of books like this. There are books that will tell you where the money goes in the budget. This is my book is about stuff that you won't find in the budget.
I was just wondering if you were familiar with their work.
The names ring a bell, but...
Secondly, I'll concede the rest of my time because we have a state legislator, here, Joe Roback over there.
Hi, Joe. And we have a judge and a former senator on the other end. Okay. Joe, you have a question?
Who's the former senator? In relationship to the IDA question, what would your advice be? I mean, I agree with the things you're saying globally. In New York State, I think it's a little bit different. We spend the most money on education, healthcare already. I'm not sure it's most efficiently. But when it comes to the things we subsidize, Hickey Freeman put 8 million package, working with the unions, we get criticized by both sides. Some people say it's corporate welfare. Other times the media will say we don't bring back enough to deliver for those things. And I was wondering earlier in your comments, do you think that all partnerships, public, private, union to keep jobs is not a good way, or is it sometimes good, sometimes bad, depending on the criteria? And that goes to this gentleman's question. You know, with the IDA, we're working very hard to make sure if they get the government money, they really create the jobs and try to focus on people who are really talking about moving to another state or taking the jobs overseas.
Now, I know that Joe and Senator Judge Dollinger will laugh at this, I hope. Boy, it's easy to be on my side of the street on this because I don't have to make those decisions, okay? I just get to describe them. There is a logical order to subsidies if you're going to have them. First of all societies have subsidies. You and I are being taxed to educate other people's children. Just as people now long gone, given the amount of gray hair in this room, were taxed so that we could get an education. All societies have transfers all the time. The question, it seems to me, is where do you get the bang for your buck? Well, first and foremost, you get it in education. Secondly, you get it in research and development, which we have been radically cutting in this country. Third, you may get it through infrastructure, highways, bridges, and you'll see our system is falling apart because we've delayed and delayed and delayed taking care of our infrastructure, and it's costing us billions and billions of dollars at pinch points and elsewhere. Fourth, you may do it in manufacturing and mining. You certainly don't want to do it in retail. If the market doesn't provide in retail, then with some rare exceptions, then why would you do that? I can think of there may be some exceptions, but as a general rule. But why would we, in the case of Donald Trump, that $89 million he got of a tax for the poor, you know what it's going for? To build high-end luxury goods, Harry Winston and Bulgari and Tourneau shops at his casino. This helps poor people? That's absurd. So I think it's very difficult, but the size of these subsidies has gotten totally out of hand, I think, overall. And I certainly can't see subsidizing commercial sports teams. You know, Karl Marx, when he wrote that religion is the opiate of the masses, just didn't anticipate the rise of commercial sports. So, all right.
Yes, they had
over
gladiators.
Here. Lady in the red.
Thank you. About the education question, you were talking earlier about, you know, young people not having an understanding of all these things. And I work with teenagers. And I just went on a trip to Albany with a group of kids, several of whom didn't know we're still at war. So this is like... what you're talking about, we need to start making a significant investment in informing our kids a little better, and not just our kids, but everybody's kids, about what's going on. Or all of this knowledge, all of this information won't be processed. You talk about the lack of critical thinking, and it's not just, it's getting progressively worse in succeeding generations because we're not educating our children.
Let me pursue your point a little bit. I've given lectures at colleges all over the country because they have budgets to bring me to speak, and once in a while they even pay me. And I have been absolutely shocked at the number of students, including students at Yale, who have said to me when I've said, why did we create this country? Well, so we can get rich. There's a whole section in the back of my book about why we created this country and its history. And when Ralph Nader, who was one of the people I asked to board the book, along with Jack Bogle and a bunch of people who didn't come through because it was a tight time schedule and it was summer vacation, called me up after the book was done. He said, you know, two things, David. One is you need to get everybody in the country to read this book so they understand what's happening. And the other is there some way to get your little couple of pages about the meaning of our country to every high school kid in America? And I got to tell you, it's really disheartening to hear people say the purpose of this country was to create wealth, because I show that it specifically was not. It absolutely was not. Ma'am. Yes, you.
I would like to ask you what you think the role of protest is. And I'm talking about protest in a fairly broad spectrum. I've lived in countries where teachers' unions have shut down the country's border or the country's airport. And here, and sometimes they don't win at all,
okay. But
they educate people.
What's the role of protest in getting social change? It's absolutely fundamental. I mean, one of the ideas of this country that we're letting slip away among young people is we gave the government its powers. You know, Article 1, Section 8, we shall give the power, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, and all the rest of Section 8. We gave that to the Congress, and we withheld other powers from our government. But we did it. And, you know, you can't question these things. That's just unbelievable. Now, on the other side, if you want to do civil disobedience as a piece of protest, I think then you have to be honest about it. You know, and then the ultimate example of honesty was when Gandhi was arrested and said, if you've read his the book, very good book that was written about him right after he died by a newspaper man, he said, Your Honor, I'm guilty of sedition, and the minute I walk out of here, I will do it again. And if you believe in the system of justice that you are administering on behalf of the British government, you must sentence me to the longest term possible. You know, but protest is fundamental. Here's a question you might think about, okay? The idea of the all-voluntary military was developed in the economics department at the University of Rochester. And if you go back and read about the arguments that were made then, and I've actually talked to, I don't know if he's still alive, to the professor who developed it, a lot of it was about how, first of all, there's this moral component that it's wrong to draft young people, in his view. He's of the Milton Friedman, we're just 300 million people in the same geographic area, we're not a society. But then the argument is it's economic. Well, think about how inexpensive an all-volunteer army has turned out to be in the last couple of years. Okay, over here. You, sir.
Do you believe in America, a Pax Americana, in finance and culture?
Do I believe in a Pax Americana? You mean, are we an empire?
Yes.
I think history will judge that we're an empire, sure.
But do you believe we should teach the whole world how to live as we live?
No, I don't think... Do I think that we should make the whole world be like us? Boy, what a boring place. What if every reporter in America was like me? Nobody, including me, would want to read the newspaper. You know, you'd have people who write funny, people who write sports, people who write cute features, people who do other kinds of serious work. And the same thing applies to governments. You know, if you have a one-world government and everyone is alike, what happens if you're the outcast? Where do you go? So, no. Well, you want to have a competitive different world and see how things work out. And I don't understand the idea that you're going to force democracy on people. You know, we tried that in Haiti. Didn't work. I mean, there's plenty of evidence that sort of doesn't work. People want democracy, they can get democracy. You, ma'am.
Yes. You had raised the whole issue about all of the manipulations that are going on around bonds. And a very interesting thing happened yesterday, you know, where they had a municipal bond sale and basically nobody came. I wonder if you could speak to that and where we are with an event like that.
Okay. Yesterday there was a big bond auction, and as the questioner said, basically nobody showed up to buy. Well, we have going on what is called in economics a liquidity crisis, not a credit crisis. You don't know if you're one of the big investment houses how secure your cash is because of this subprime mortgage mess and the securitization of things and cross defaults and all of these things we allowed Wall Street to do under the guise of, quote, deregulation. And it's going to cause a lot more problems. We're nowhere near the end of this, okay? Now, do I think the whole world's going to go to hell in a handbasket? No. Yesterday, I was supposed to sign a 2/3 of a million-dollar note for a building for our hotel company. and, you know, we couldn't close, but I want to close, and I'm going to sign that note. It's a lot of money to me. And it may turn out that it's, you know, at the wrong step in the market, but I, in the long run, you know, human beings make progress. Of course, there was the Middle Ages. Ma'am.
Could you talk some more about the cost of the war in Iraq and how that's affecting us, and the comparison with what we could have spent that money for instead?
The question is, can I talk about the cost of the war in Iraq and how we could have spent the money? I don't. There's not a word about the war in Iraq in my book, okay? Let me do it a little bit differently, all right? We are spending in this country an enormous amount of money on war. It isn't just the Pentagon budget. It's the debt from the past. It's the legacy costs of war. I went to school on the GI Bill because technically I'm a war orphan because my dad was 100% disabled. My parents were supported all those years by the government because of World War II, courtesy of the Nazis. We're still paying for, I guess, the last World War I soldier just died, or we're down to one, something like that. But we're still in debt from it. Here's a question to ask. How come these Europeans, after paying all those taxes, and they pay a lot more than we do, are so rich? How come they're not in debt? How come they own their homes free and clear? How can that be? It's because, A, they're not paying for wars. Secondly, they have government policies that spend those tax dollars to grease the wheels of commerce. Very educated workforce. They don't protect jobs. They protect the economy. They've learned that lesson. Protecting jobs doesn't work. Because if people can't be fired, then employers won't hire them. They've learned how to do that. The strongest fiscal balance sheet. A fiscal balance sheet means the government's balance sheet, just like yours. What's your net worth? The strongest fiscal balance sheets in the world. Sweden, Denmark, Finland. Excuse me? I thought they were all these horrible socialists. They have the strongest fiscal balance sheets. They spend their money on daycare, although a little asterisk to that. You know where the best preschool daycare in all of Western Europe and North America is?
Rochester, New York.
I cannot get any national news organization to write about this. I have tried to get my newspaper. I've gone to friends at the Washington Post. I've talked to people who are friends of mine at the networks. Nobody will write about it. It is an astonishing story. The cost of preschool daycare is enormous. The cost of preschool daycare that makes a difference? This much more. This much more. Long-term effort, and by the way, it turns out people in Dayton, Ohio, had the same idea that grows here in Rochester about 15 years ago and got similar results, just like two different guys invented the telephone at once, et cetera. Somebody else over here had a hand up. Are we out of questions? Because we got about 6 minutes. I said we could get till noon. Sir?
Health insurance?
Health insurance.
Yeah, you mentioned, which I agree with, this religious conviction that industry has. But in terms of the health insurance industry itself, do you see any blockage?
Ah, okay. Is the health insurance industry an obstacle to... There are three chapters in my book about health care, okay? There are little heroes in my book. Everybody in my book in free lunch is not a scalawag. One of them is a guy in town that most of you probably think is a pay pig named Howard Berman, who used to run Excellus. He was getting $1.5 million a year. Howard could have made tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars off of Excellus and didn't do it. And when I asked him why, and Howard is not a nice, he's a pugnacious guy. Any of you here who know him know that. I asked Howard, why didn't you do it, Howard? All these other people I write about in the book did it. I was the guy who first exposed this 20 years ago, what was going on, when I was at the LA Times. And Howard, I said, Howard, you could be so rich, you could have your own jet, you could do anything. And he looked at me and he said, because it would be wrong. Because it would mean increasing my wealth at the expense of the community's health. And the problem is that we don't have more people doing that, and that we have government rules that allow the abuses to go on. But you'll see a whole section in there about this, about people who became billionaires off the health insurance system, about why they are an entrenched problem in this, and why McKinsey, the most prestigious business consulting firm in America, says that we are spending so much money on made-up paperwork and stupid job creation denying health care benefits. It's the equivalent of every single one of us waking up in the morning, getting out a George Washington and a match and burning it. And on Sundays, burning too. Now, some people, by the way, have argued that all this health care denial insurance stuff is creating a lot of jobs, especially inner city jobs. Well, you want a job creation program? Here's my recommendation. Let's ban earth-moving equipment, and all construction sites will employ people with teaspoons. Okay, one more. One more.
People's insurance. However, there are a lot of millionaires on Medicaid because in New York State they have loopholes such as spousal refusal. and they have lawyers that can find those loopholes. And I was wondering if you were aware.
I was not aware. The question is that it turns out Medicaid, the speaker says, has some loopholes where there are millionaires who are on the system because of various loopholes. And all systems have loopholes and rules. And no, I was not aware of that. But I think the deeper issue you want to ask is, have any of you ever spent one moment of your life thinking, you know what we need in this country? We need kindergarten insurance. That's an absolute necessity. We need to have police insurance and road insurance and park insurance and library insurance. Well, of course not. Those are services. Why do we talk about health insurance? Health insurance implies denial. It implies profit. Now, you can't have capitalism without insurance. There is no capitalism without insurance. No one's going to ship their goods from the port at Venice by ship to Bruges in the Netherlands in the 1400s unless they get insurance, because they know that about one ship in 40 will either sink or get lost or pirates will steal it. Something bad will happen. So you've got to have insurance. It is a fundamental part of capitalism. Well, maximizing return to capital is the right standard for capital. That's the standard. Maximizing return is the right standard for capital. What the heck does that have to do with people's health care? Maximizing their health status should be the most. If you'll read Free Lunch, I promise you that you will begin to see and listen to and read the news in a different way. Things that just went by you before were going to make sense. My job is to show people what's happened. And if you read it and you find out it's what I said it is, because some of you may read it and go, "Bruh." But if you find out you feel it's what I said it was, then here's what I'd like to ask you to do. After you finish it, call up your friends. Send them an email. Tell them when you go to work, "You should read this book. It's astonishing what you will learn in this book." So that's what I'm asking you for. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a talk by David K. Johnston on his most recent book, Free Lunch: How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. The talk was given February 16th in Rochester, New York, and comes to us thanks to Carl Pultz of Alembic Productions. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Happy 16th anniversary, Seniors for Peace. I'm recording this on January 29, 2019, after returning last night from a huge, heartwarming celebration of the Seniors for Peace in Mill Valley, California. They live in the Redwoods Retirement Community just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. Every Friday from 4 to 5 p.m., rain or shine, ongoing, and for the last 16 years, they go to the busy intersection outside their home with banners, posters, and hand drums, cymbals, guitars, and a violin, and amaze passing drivers and the students of the high school right across with their songs and message for peace and justice. On their website, millvalleyseniorsforpeace.org, they explain that they first came out in January 2003. The Bush administration threatened a preemptive unilateral war against Iraq. They joined peace-minded people around the world in opposing the war. Sadly, they continued to have reasons to come out against war, while at the same time doing their own organizing. For example, they had already raised money to buy back guns, and when the students of the high school across the street walked out for gun control, they joined them. Seniors for Peace protest the separation of children from their parents on the U.S.-Mexico border and also demand due process for asylum seekers. And they're just beginning a campaign to abolish or amend the Electoral College and have set a date to meet Jared Huffman, the congressperson for the area. Yesterday afternoon, at the 16th anniversary, the founders of Seniors for Peace were honored. And here's my radio documentary, recorded in 2003. Now I'm taking you back into the sun-filled lobby of the Redwoods Retirement Community. That's where I first met Raleigh Mulvey.
You mean you want me to sing this thing for you?
That would be great.
Oh, I'm going to lay down my sword and shield. Down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside, I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield. Down by the riverside and study ever no more. Okay, everyone.
As Raleigh sang, the growing group of seniors drew closer, among them the two women who had organized the demonstrations, Phyllis Hamilton and Nora Boscoff. I got to speak to Phyllis first.
We actually thought maybe 30 people, so we did 30 signs. Well, when almost 100 showed up last week, we were just overwhelmed because we didn't expect that kind of response.
Have you given it some thought why that is?
The people here had lived through several wars, and I think having lived all these years through past very tragic, sad experiences, they have maybe gained a perspective on it that younger people may not have.
What was your war experience?
I was working at the radio station, KTRB, in Modesto, California, when World War II was ongoing. And I remember when it came across the teletype, war ended that night, what excitement there was in this little town. People were just, oh, so joyous that the war was over. So, as I say, I think in my case, remembering all of that and the tragedy that had gone before and the friends who had lost people just has given me personally a whole different perspective on what's happening now.
I've been doing this since I'm 15 years old.
How many years ago is that?
I'm 84 years old now. And once I went to one of these things and my father said, "Why are you all dressed up?" I said, "Well, I'm going out with my friends." He said, "Well, don't give them your name." Because he knew I was going out. to protest on union stuff when they weren't allowing unions, you know.
Where was that?
That was in New York at Orbach's, but it was actually a department store called Orbach's. And we got arrested because we weren't supposed to be there. So we were 24 hours in there at age 15. They kept us in jail.
How did they treat you?
Very bad. We were very young and very idealistic, you know. We have to go.
That was Nora Boscoff being whisked away in her wheelchair. I followed her out the door and caught up with a very dignified-looking gentleman. We walked together to join the demonstration. What's in your life that makes you come out against the war here?
I was in the British Army in World War II, and I was in the desert campaigns in North Africa and into Italy, and I saw what war can do to civilians as well as military people. I also came to the United States because I admired the United States for its freedom, its lack of overt class distinction, and I came with my family. I became a citizen freely, and I love this country. At the same time, I feel that I'm entitled to speak out against what the administration is doing. What I see here is the erosion of freedoms, a slipping toward a horribly right-wing situation in this country, the database of high school children and such and so forth. I mean, the whole thing is anathema to me. I believe in freedom, but I'm frustrated and saddened by what is happening with this arrogant administration that we have right now.
We are on one of the busiest corners in Mill Valley. The commute traffic is now going home. The people who feel like they want peace or are at least very friendly toward us honk, and we have our drummers out, and we'll be singing protest songs when the drummers get tired. But the drummers seem to have a lot of energy and go on for a long time.
Even though they, too, are between 70 and 90 years old?
Oh, yes. Maybe 60 to 100 is a better range. Rose, do you want to say something on the radio?
Oh, on the radio. I have another idea. Maybe we don't need George Bush anymore. I was going to make a sign that said, in a democracy, a loose cannon doesn't work. Impeach George Bush.
A loose cannon. That's a great slogan for us.
What made you think that way?
I've been feeling that way for some time. It is not only the war. It's the attack on the environment and really on the common people of America. I think his time has come and should be gone. I think the real reason is oil, money, and I think he's hoping to get enough money out of that oil that he can pay for the war.
Yeah. I was sending copies of our last one to my relatives in New York, and my daughter said, I'm really proud of you. She said, I'll be 90 in 2-3 months, so I'm walking, and there are people here who are not well, but they're saying, this is what we're fighting for, and we're on the brink, really, now, and that's sad.
Oh, you remember World War II?
Yes, I do. Of course I do. I was in Paris in World War II, and I was scared to death. I was only 12 or 13.
Who else would like to talk to me?
I don't think anybody would understand me. But we're very
just one sentence.
We're very intense in our feeling. We hope others do what we're doing. Maybe it can get to Mr. Bush.
I came to see what she was up to.
Are you family?
Yes, I'm her son. Yeah.
So what do you think?
I'm very proud of her. I'm very proud of her. And I'm proud of all the people at the Redwoods.
Do you have this in your past as mother and son going out for some issue, or is this your first?
We started with demonstrating against nuclear weapons in the 50s. And Vietnam in the 60s, civil rights. I remember being maybe 10 or 11 years old and walking by Woolworths in downtown Chicago, and the civil rights movement was picketing. And that was where we were on our way to, and my mother said, "We don't cross picket lines." Was a big moment in my life, something I always remember.
I'm here because I think that we need this peace. I think that the world needs it, and I see no reason to mess it up with any kind of war. Even in families, we don't need war. So,
have you come out for peace before?
No, never in my life. No.
So this is a big step.
Well, it is. My apartment's over there, and I could see them out here. So I thought, well, and I have 6 children, and all of them said, "Are you out there protesting?" We hope so.
Tell me why you're here.
Well, I'm here because I'm against the war. And I also just finished reading Secrets by Ellsberg, and he talks about all the lies that people in the government from the president down tell in order to carry out what they think is best for the people without discussing it with the people. Then they try to give them information which is not legitimate. And Bush is so anxious to go to war that he doesn't really care under what pretense he goes to war. And I don't think that young people should be killed for that reason.
My name is Sylvia Siegel. I'm a consumer advocate of some years. This is the best demonstration for anti-war that I've seen. We can't have another war. We have too many gorgeous and intelligent sons, and we have to hang on to them. Make love, not war.
Right on, Sylvia!
I was a CPS in World War II, conscientious objector, so I've always been for peace.
Even so, that war, that yeah. Took some guts to be that way then.
Yeah.
Were you in a camp?
Yes.
Where?
Oh, we surveyed all over the southwest of the United States. I was in a survey group. We weren't released until the 46, the war was over.
What were your reasons? Were they religious or political or both?
Essentially, you know, I believed in Gandhi and Schweitzer and Kurogawa, you know, the Japanese peace activist. So they were the people I tried to emanate.
Did you count?
Well, I counted as well as I could. There's so many people here, you really can't get an accurate count. But a conservative figure that I got was 120. So let's figure by the time 5 o'clock comes around here, and that's another 40 minutes, we ought to have anywhere from 130 to 140, maybe 150 people here on this corner in Mill Valley in our little town, and we're making a statement.
And what do you think is the average age?
Last week, the oldest person here was 95. I think we've got some people that are older than that. You look around you and you can see 10 or 20, maybe as many as 30 people sitting here in their wheelchairs, standing here with their walkers, or trying to get around with their canes, and they're out here in the cold weather here in beautiful downtown Mill Valley, and we don't like what the hell is going on in the country with our leaders in Washington. We don't want a war. The country doesn't want a war. The world doesn't want a war, and we're going to do our very best to try and stop it.
That was Wally Mulvey again, his guitar slung over his shoulder. I decided to return to the Redwoods Retirement Center. By now, I was so intrigued by the wit, passion, compassion, and amazing depth of life experience that I hoped to find somebody to engage in a conversation. I got my recording equipment ready on a comfortable sofa and asked the first person who came by to check her mailbox to join me. Here is Kathleen Berge.
My life changed when I was in England during World War II with the American Red Cross, working with combat flyers. And as I watched the combat flyers, the American boys, fly over Germany, and many of them did not come back. They went down in the channel, and I watched the German planes go down. And then I was in the bombings in England, in the bomb shelters, and watched homes flattened, shops torn apart. And so the whole fiasco of war had no more glamour for me. So after the war, I went into Germany and worked with the newly liberated slave laborers that Hitler had kidnapped from other countries that he occupied. And amongst the slave laborers, I found these orphan children. I was with United Nations, and then I went back with the Quakers and lived in the camps and worked with the children. So I saw what war did, not only to cities, but also to families and to both sides, whether it was England and America or it was Poland, the occupied countries, and even Germany. And then I worked in Korea after the Korean War with North Korean widows that came down to fled during the war, and in Yugoslavia with Hungarian refugees after the Russians took over Hungary. So what really is agonizing right now is we're going to be doing this again. We're going to be going in to terrorize the Iraqi people, all of the countries around Iraq. Middle East is going to be shaken up. And I think that it's such so tragic that the brilliance of brain and the money has gone in to weaponry, diabolical ways of killing, and not in to peace. How can we make harmony and peace in the world? It's a tragic thing. And I think that under this administration, with the hawks in charge, we're going to be making more and more enemies. We're breeding hate. That's what we're really doing. And this whole business now of terrorists in our country and the high alert in our country is such a tragic thing because it's coming out of our choice to do more violence through war making.
From your brief experience with the United Nations, what are your hopes and expectations for the role of the United Nations now?
Well, I think it's totally tragic. I came back from the wars in just when the United Nations was formed, and I went out to Muir Woods, where the delegation went and the great Cathedral Grove, and I thought, this is the end of all war. And I think the most tragic thing is that this country particularly has not in any way supported the United Nations. They have not paid their way. They have not supported the United Nations. And I think that's the tragedy, because unless there is a unity of countries coming together, then I think it's hopeless, really. And I think the role should be strengthened. I was privileged to be at the United Nations when Eleanor Roosevelt was there, and she founded the Work for Children. And I worked with them again. They were the umbrella in Yugoslavia when I worked in Yugoslavia, two Quakers, two of us, under the United Nations. But I think that that needs to be strengthened as a really living body.
That was Kathleen Berge, a participant in the weekly demonstrations against war in Iraq. When she left, I introduced myself to two women who sat across from me. Sarah Wasink told me her story.
I come from Holland, and we lived through 5 years of war. We were occupied by the Germans. We were bombed for 5 days by the Germans and for 5 years by our allies. And it doesn't matter who it is. Bombing is bombing. Of course, we were not treated so well by the Germans, but we really felt for them that they were totally demolished in the war. Of course, London and great parts of England were too, but what was the use? And I know that Hitler was very dangerous, but it's crazy to compare Saddam Hussein with Hitler. He has none of the power, and we would, if we make war, we would get the whole Arab world and all the Muslims against. I think it's a dreadful thing to think of. I often can't sleep. Like you think, what must their families feel? And once you've been in war, and especially when you have a baby, you feel, and the bombs fall all around you, boy, you feel helpless. We spent the first month of his life every night in the cellar. We had the German U-boat harbor quite near. And so there were the Allied bombs, and then there were the waves and waves of bombs going to Germany coming over. And you heard that awful sound. We also heard the first, what was it, the V2 come over, the first missiles. It was like a diesel truck driving over your head. It was toward the end of the war. I cannot believe that any woman would be, if you know how much work it is and how much love it takes to raise a kid, would ever want war. To have them destroyed, not other people's kids, not your own kids, nobody. And I'm very glad that you will talk about it, because the radio reaches a lot of people.
How old were you when you had to spend time in air raid shelters?
I was 24, nearly 24 when the war started, and it was 5 years, so I was 28 when it ended, and we had one baby when I was 26, and it was then you really get scared. We had dug a shelter in the yard with an oak table over it that was supposed to be safe, but then of course it rained, and the hole that we had dug filled with water, so we went back to sitting under the stairway. But it's no way to live. And my husband, he worked at the only steel mill Holland had, and he was bombed regularly by the Allies, although they never delivered. They always sabotaged. They never delivered anything to the Germans they could use, but the underground didn't seem to pass it on. So they were often bombed, and then he was in open trenches, and he would come home with dirt in his hair, and he said, if the bombs fall right overhead, you know, you're safe because they'll go forward with the plane. But if they fall behind you, you're really scared. He was also a reserve officer, so he could be picked up at any time. In Belgium and France, they were all put in internment camps. All these 5 years, I never knew in the morning whether I would see him back. And really, in the night, I didn't either, because then some Dutch people would call, yell through the mail slot in the door, he has to go underground and disappear because the Germans are going to pick him up. They never did, but he had to go underground, and there was a curfew, so he could be shot every... He wasn't, luckily, but he became 86, which is pretty good, but it's no way to live. And we were lucky. I mean, our house wasn't bombed, wasn't destroyed. Think of what happened in Germany and in England. And the Allies often missed. The Germans would have something vital next to hospitals. So once the Allies, by accident, bombed a hospital in The Hague. And, you know, the patients were killed, the nurses, the ministers who visited, everyone was killed. And then if you know the families, then you see the devastation. It's a totally unfeminine thing, I think, a war. It's people who never grew up and still want to play in the street corner, cowboys and Indians or whatever. I cannot believe that any woman would be for war.
That was Sarah Wasink, who survived 5 years of bombing in Holland. As I tried to engage the very quiet woman who sat next to her, Sarah told me that she would not talk about her life. Why? Her friend, Sarah said, survived the worst bombing of any European city in World War II. Some say that the death toll in the Allied bombing of Dresden was double that of the city of Hiroshima. When the smoke cleared, the whole center of the city was pulverized, but the large white oil tanks owned by the British-controlled Shell Oil were left intact.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to Latin Waves. This is Sylvia Richardson. I'm joined by Maria Paez, a Venezuelan Canadian sociologist. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for contacting me. It's always a pleasure to be on your radio station.
Paint a picture for us, if you would. What is happening in Venezuela today?
Well, the first thing to make very clear to people is this is not a coup d'etat, what's happening. What is happening is a neo-colonial war against a sovereign country in Latin America. This is the United States and its allies wanting to take over a sovereign country that is sitting on the largest petroleum reserve in the world and that has a government that dares to say that they are independent, that they want to take their own politics and policies, you know, independent of whatever the Americans want. Now, Venezuela has never been an enemy of the United States. Venezuela, in fact, Venezuelans really like the United States in terms of its culture and its people and so forth, and has always sold and wanted, has never said, none of its presidents has said, we won't sell our petroleum. What is Venezuela going to do with petroleum? Eat it? No, it wants to sell it. So here is basically a friendly country, but it did two things. You see, it decided that it wanted to be sovereign, to decide its own policies, internal and foreign, and it decided that the riches of Venezuela should not go to mostly to these foreign corporations, should not go to the elites that used to control the government, but should go for public housing, public schooling, public health, public infrastructure. The change of Venezuela, the Venezuela of these last 20 years, with the Venezuela that I knew as I was growing up, is phenomenal. I wish I could have sort of pictures that I could show you and say, this was before, this is now. So all of this is highly threatening to the United States. And now with this erratic and immoral president that they have, very ignorant president, who has surrounded himself with the worst possible presidential help. Well, Abrahams is a known war criminal who was in charge of the Contras, the violence in Central America, the violence in the Middle East. Bolton, who can't find someone who is more warmongering than Bolton. What have they done? They picked a poor man. This guy Guaido, he's a nothing, and this young man, they paid him. And he stood on a public plaza of Venezuela and said, you know, I declare myself the president of Venezuela. And countries like Canada, what a shame. I can't believe how low the Trudeau administration, his appalling foreign minister Freeland, have fallen to have trashed in such a blatant way international law. And they fill their mouth saying that they respect the rule of law. And this is ridiculous. How can you say that you recognize a man who stood on a plaza and said he was the president of Venezuela against a man who has obtained 6.5 million votes in a clean, independent elections, witnessed by 150 international observers, that not even the other candidates thought it was fraudulent. They all accepted this. So this is a farce. Any idea that what is happening against Venezuela has to do with legitimacy or democracy or that Maduro is a dictator, that is nonsense. That is what they want to wrap up their pillaging. You know what? I believe Canada is leading, the Lima Group is leading this charge against Venezuela as a quid pro quo for the trade deal that it made with the United States.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the way this propaganda model has developed, because if you look at academics have long talked about what manufacturing consent meant, right? In the 1980s,
yes,
Noam
exactly.
Chomsky wrote a book about manufacturing consent, this idea that they can create a sort of process to create public consent. In this case, they're using, you know, images of people leaving the country to declare that this is an issue of humanitarian crisis of sorts. Now, just as an example, El Salvador is a country of 6 million people, and by any record, they would tell you that there's more than half its population living abroad, and yet it's never been declared a country in crisis or anything like that. However, in the case of Venezuela, this is being used as an example. Can we talk a little bit about what the numbers
yes.
in terms of...
This is a clear model that they applied in Libya, and they applied in Ukraine, and also they applied in, of course, the famous weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So this is what they do. They set up a puppet government. They then try to manufacture this dissent, usually using a what's called a red flag. They promote some sort of horrible incident of killing of some of the other and say that this is due to the other side. And then the third is they take over the country. So this is what the model they're trying to apply to Venezuela, the same one they applied for Libya, the same one they applied to Ukraine. The photos that appeared yesterday in the newspapers here in Toronto was of a huge march supporting Guaido. Well, it so happened that I spoke with three people who were at that march. I called up, I picked up my phone, and they said, no, it was hardly anybody there. The photo that was published here by the Toronto Star and elsewhere were photos of the past or some other demonstration some other time, but it wasn't this one. So they're manufacturing consent, as you say. These migrants on the border with Colombia, well, most of them are Colombians. There are 6 million Colombians living in Venezuela. But more than that, many of them live on the border. So if you ever go here to the border with the United States, you know, in Windsor and such, you know that there are people who work on both sides of the border and go here and go there. Well, the same thing in Venezuela. You have a population that regularly goes back and forth along that border. And many of them, as I say, are, now that the situation is bad, are Colombians going back to their country because they came to Venezuela when things were okay. Now they want to leave because, you know, the squeeze that the sanctions, the economic blockade that has been established against Venezuela, just like the one against Cuba. So they use these pictures of these migrants. They use these pictures of these supposed marches, which are fraudulent. They don't exist. So they manipulate this in a terrible, really open lies. All of this in order to justify the violence that they are really actually perpetrating. Now, this is a clear plot They're trying to do the same thing they did in Ukraine. In Ukraine, they established an extremely right-wing government in Ukraine. In Libya, well, poor Libya. I don't even want to think about Libya. Libya used to be a very viable country with a very high standard for its region, and it's destroyed. Now, this is all started a long time ago, and the mantra is Maduro is a dictator. Maduro's a terrible person. Maduro is a dictator. Well, I don't know how they get to this, how they are so virulent against Maduro, especially a country like Canada that has such good relationships with Saudi Arabia, you know, a country whose officials killed, a journalist and dismembered him inside and one of their embassies, but yet nothing against, Saudi Arabia. So you see, this is all a hypocrisy. Venezuela is a little country, so they think, oh, we can take it over. But they've got another thing coming, because Maduro is no dictator. Maduro is very much loved by his people. Do you know what there has happened since a week ago when all of this has started? The people have surrounded the presidential palace and are there permanently, because they want to protect the president. They feel that if they stay outside the presidential palace, they will be able to protect it. Now, what people doesn't do that for a dictator, but the love that the Venezuelans have shown both for Chavez and for Maduro is extraordinary, which I've never seen in any other, politician government
around here. I would argue that is not so much love for their president, but love for their own autonomy and right to elect
exactly
whoever they want as president. It's not about the person, it's about their own self-dignity.
Oh, no, I totally agree. Since the United States started this attack on Venezuela, you should see the fervor of the Chavistas. It's like they had set them on fire. They are incensed. And I'll tell you something, I'm also in contact with people in the opposition. The people in the opposition are furious about what the Americans are doing. The leader, the guy who used to be the main leader of the opposition, Capriles, I don't know whether you remember his name, he came out against Guaido, saying this is an outrage. So many of the seasoned politicians of the opposition are against what's happening here. In Venezuela, there's a lot of people in the opposition, about 16 opposition parties and such. Three are the biggest and such. But the United States and Canada has allied itself with the one tiny party that espouses violence. They were the ones who did La Salida, went on the street, killed people, 114 people killed, burned young men alive because they looked Chavista. This is Guaido, Leopoldo López, and Maria Corina Machado, who was just interviewed on CBC Radio 2 days ago. So we must get this farce out of our heads. This is not about democracy. This is not about Maduro being a dictator. This is not about elections. This is all about a neo-colonial war. That is, they want to establish a new colonization of Venezuela. They want to establish Venezuela as a puppet, a state, and they would control its resources. This is what it's all about, a new way of colonizing. And one of their main, tools or weapons has been the economic. So everyone says, oh, look at this failed, socialist society. Look at the terrible thing that Maduro has done, that, the inflation and all of that. Well, it's a blockade, just like they did for Cuba. They have robbed Venezuela of $7 billion from PDVSA. The United States has taken it in the United States, $12 billion in crude oil. They have robbed these assets that belong to Venezuela that are in the United States. Venezuela is challenging this in U.S. courts. And you know what? They're going to win, because this goes against the tenet of capitalism, which is private property. But you know what politics is. They could still keep it and not give it out. They are so powerful. So I tell you, we in Canada have to be alert, because most Canadians don't know what the foreign affairs minister is doing. This foreign affairs minister, Freeland, is a disaster for Canada. She is a throwback to the Cold War. She is a rabid anti-communist, anti-socialist, anti-progressive, you know. And she has thrown all idea of Canada's sense of rights, sense of principles, the role that Canada has often had as an honest broker, all that's out the window. Canada's despised now and then. I have read, you know, article after article of writers in Latin America calling Canada, you know, the lapdog of the United States, doing the dirty work for the United States. This is a terrible situation for this country. I don't know how Canada's, reputation is going to be, fixed, if ever, over this. I really am disgusted with the Trudeau administration. I'm disgusted with this phrase that Freeland keeps on saying, and Trudeau also said, we respect the rule of law. They're not respecting the rule of law of Venezuela, of Venezuela's constitution, of Venezuela's electoral law. They are trashing it. And this is so important because, you see, this goes against the charter of the UN, the charter of the OAS, against all the regulations between nations, sovereign nations. They're trashing international law. And this is so dangerous for every country, especially every country that's small and less powerful than this. And they go on about the rule of law, and it's a farce. It's a lie. They are playing with fire in going against the international law in trying to bring down a legitimate government in Venezuela.
Anyone that has followed the news has seen the kinds of appointments the Trump administration has made. For instance, the appointment of Carlos Becchio as the White House representative. Oh. He was named by the Senator Marco Rubio on Twitter and then ratified by the National Assembly. Now, this person was an ExxonMobil employee. So, clearly there's an issue there. But can we talk a little bit about what we, those who do not support war, those who believe that people not only do not want to be slaves of empires and, want to be live sovereign and able to dictate who their government is, what are we doing right? Because I think that there's a lot of things that people in Venezuela are doing right at this moment. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that because there's a history behind this beautiful revolution. Venezuela didn't just become the Venezuela that everyone admires. When I went to South Africa, people were talking about Venezuela and all the changes that they've made. Can we talk about the significance of the Caracazo, for instance, that is, it's about to celebrate yet another anniversary, and the way that this country has been formed into the autonomous and vibrant nation that they are?
Well, the Caracazo on the 27th of February, 1989, was the first public or collective protest against the dictates of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. These institutions twisted the arm of the president at that time, Carlos Andrés Pérez, and told him, look, we're going to give you some money, but these are the things you have to do. Amongst the things they had to do was to bring up the prices of public transport. And this in a country at that time that had, people absolutely depended on sometimes only one bus route. I mean, it was pretty bad. So the people woke up on this day, and they went to the bakery and found out that the bread was about 5-6 times more expensive than it was the day before. Many of them went to catch a bus, and they couldn't take it because, again, it was about 10 times higher from one day to the other, without any kind of explanation to the nation. The prices were just jacked up. So the people took to the streets. Venezuelans do that, They took to the streets to protest this. The, what the army did? You know what the government did? It kept the army units from Caracas inside the barracks. And they brought in basically young recruits from the interior of the country so that they wouldn't, be of the same people that were there. And they slaughtered the people on the streets. some say 3,000, but you know, it was just horrendous. And that made an incredible impression on the whole country. I have newspapers from that time, and you had people who were more or less center or right or whatever also speaking the horror that had occurred. Well, the people didn't forget that. And one of the people who didn't forget that was Chavez. Chavez happened to have, I think it was malaria at that time, one of his bouts of malaria, and he was sick. And so he didn't go out, and many of his units weren't called. But afterwards, he called a meeting of his soldiers, and he said, "We have to make an oath right here." And there's this famous tree in Venezuela that Bolivar stood beside. They said, "We must make a sacred oath that our arms will never be turned against our people." He said, "They are using us for their own purpose, and they're making us kill our own people." And that is the basis of the loyalty of the armed forces of Venezuela with its constitution. So when you hear the leader of the army, the main general speaking, the first thing he says, "We are here to defend the constitution of Venezuela." This is not understood by Ms. Freeland and Mr. Trudeau and all these appallingly corrupt governments of the Lima group. So the Caracazo was a seminal moment in the life, in the political life of Venezuela. And it is remembered every year. It was spontaneous. No one was actually, there was no party or any kind of mastermind behind it. It was the spontaneous rising of the Venezuelan people. Just like it spontaneously rose to protect Chavez when he was kidnapped and nearly killed in 2002. So these are important moments in the life of Venezuela. And right now is one of them, because they are beleaguered by the international press. You know what? The press here, and I've just come back from England, and over there it's equally vicious, they don't report the huge marches that have occurred all over the country in support of the constitution and Maduro. Indeed, one of the persons that I was speaking to said to me that the march that was done by the petroleum workers and everybody else in solidarity with them was greater than the marches when Chavez was alive. So there is enormous support in Venezuela. You know, they keep saying Venezuela is a polarized nation. Well, the polarization is not equal. The majority of the people of Venezuela support its constitution and its legitimate government. And this is not what this manufacturing of consent, as you say. So polarization is like saying, oh, they're, you know, 50-50. It's not 50-50. And with this recent attack on the country, I've spoken with opposition people. They are appalled, and they are not following, you know, the tenets of these supposed leaders of the opposition that the United States is backing. Where is Guaido right now? You know where he is? He's holing up in the American embassy. What kind of leader, let alone president, is hiding in the American embassy? So, but what is very serious is the United States has taken Venezuela's money in CITGO. The CITGO is the oil company that it has in the United States, which is very big one. But it will have some trouble in keeping that money, because it turns out that half of the shares of CITGO is owned by Russia. And the taking of the assets of a corporation, forget whether it's CITGO or ExxonMobil or anybody else, is robbery. And this doesn't go well amongst, you know, the rule of this capitalism that we live in. So Venezuela has sued the United States in a U.S. court, I think the New York court. And I think that they will win, because this is outrageous piracy. We're looking at pirates right here. We're looking at a neo-colonial grab. We're looking at carpetbaggers. This is what is happening right now. And all of this little fluff about democracy is just a smokescreen. The changes in Venezuela, I don't even know where to begin to tell you. First of all, literacy and education, when I read, was about three-quarters of the nation is studying something. We have free education from kindergarten to university. There's no more illiteracy. I mean, this is really important. The health is due very much to the help of Cuba. We at the beginning, it was only Cuban doctors. Now we have Cuban doctors, but we also have Venezuelan doctors that have been graduated under a new curricula that was, Cubans helped establish this new curricula, to do with community health and general health and all of this. And so now we have hospitals. We have more clinics that have been created than in the last 40 years, or the previous 40 years. So you go to a small town and there'll be a doctor in that small town. This is quite amazing. Then I think one of the most amazing things that have happened is the housing. If you should go to Caracas, you will see a very sparkling sort of modern city surrounded by hills and mountains. And along those hills, there's a ring of what Ali Primera called las casas de cartón, the houses of carton, of cardboard, because the slum areas were all around Caracas. Well, no more. In these last 2 years of terrible economic blockade, Venezuela has created 2.5 million public housing units. Some of these are little houses, especially in the rural areas, the houses, and some of them are low high rises. I have seen them. I've been inside them. I have looked at these really lovely houses. They're not sort of cheap kind of stuff. And this is a monumental achievement that I don't think any other country that I know of in the world has done. In 2 years, built 2.5 million public housing, with running water, electricity, and the facilities of this sort. Why? The government says the bulk of the money that comes from that comes to the government from the sale of petroleum must go into the public sphere, the public housing, the public education, the public this and the other. It's enormous. It's 60-odd% of the income. So, of course, all of this money used to go to the private sector, you see. And that's why they're so furious against Venezuela, the elite, this wealthy elite that is behind the opposition in Venezuela. They're furious because they don't control the goose that lays the golden eggs anymore, the money that comes from the oil. And if they have to sell their soul and the soul of Venezuela to the international corporations and the United States to do it, they will be fine because they will be the minions. The minions, they will sort of control Venezuela for the sake of these people.
It inspires you not only that the Venezuelan people will defend their revolution, but also that the world will do its part to be in solidarity.
What inspires me is that we have learned through what has happened in this last decade or so in the Middle East. We have seen the bodies and the bombs and the deaths, and we are determined that this will not happen in Latin America, which has declared itself a zone of peace. So I will put all my effort, and I will beg everyone around me that I can, if you love peace, make a stand here, because we cannot afford to have war on the soil of Venezuela, because it will turn into a regional war. This, I have no doubt in my mind, any invasion of Venezuela will be a terrible thing for that country and those around it. And it will be a bad thing for the soul of Canada, for us who live here, and we cannot see our country do atrocious things without us. And I believe in the Canadian people. I think the Canadian people are a peaceful, loving people who sometimes, unfortunately, are a bit indifferent to what the federal government is doing. But I beg those in this particular moment to please go to the candidates, especially this election that's coming, and speak up for peace and speak up for not going against a friendly country, which is a democracy in this hemisphere.